Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today. We have a fantastic program for you. Coming up later in the hour, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition on carry permit reform, as well as some gun owner privacy protections. Also, Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA media liaison, will be with us next hour. We've got lead ammo ban hearings in Minnesota, plus we'll talk permitless carry in the state of Georgia. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report says Hillary's emails are not going away. I guess maybe a bigger question is an indictment forthcoming? Stacey Washington, Stacey on the right, will join us talking about a new story asserting that the change in gun laws in Missouri has led to the state becoming something akin to Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, or Fury Road, maybe, with more trees. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us as well. Plus, we have the hero of the day. We have the deal of the day. We have the good guy of the day. As a matter of fact, we have an armed citizen story that we're not even going to wait until hour three to share with you. We're going to talk about it in just a little bit. But right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend Jim Garrity from National Review. Jim, how are you, sir?
Cam, how are you today?
I am good. So I CC'd you on a tweet earlier. I don't know if you had a chance to see this or not. All is coming true, Jim. All is, you know, just it's happening as I foretold. Kanye West, 2016.
It is. Now, you know, we should point out that this was a gathering of conservative bloggers, and we're tossing around potential ideas for Donald Trump's running mate. And, Cam, were you the one who came up with the idea of Trump-Kanye 2016?
I was. I said this would be
I just give you credit. I believe I may have made one or two snarky tweets about it. Then I put together the mock-up campaign poster. And it looks really good. I went with Make America Gold Again. but I'm sure other people can look through Kanye's lyrics and song titles and make something that kind of fits better for the pair of them. People have pointed out, what makes us talking about this today is this report in the New York Post, headline, Kanye West supports Donald Trump.
So there
finally,
you go.
These two modest men, well known for their lack of interest in the materialistic good life, who always strive to see the inner beauty in people, and who are known for their decorum, their respect for others, their taciturn, shy personas, could conceivably team up and, you know, like we were joking about this, but there's a part of me in the back of my mind, no, actually, if it was Trump-Kanye, he would win, and he would win in a landslide.
Well, it would be 70%. And you'd see record high turnout.
Yeah, and
I have no doubt.
We are accused of being elitists for occasionally using phrases like low information voters and stuff. But look, there are a lot of Americans who are really interested in pop culture, who are really interested not just in Kanye's music, but obviously the media empire that the Kardashians have developed. And that interests them way more than, you know.
Well, just look at the ratings for the Oscars compared to any one of the presidential debates. Right. And the Oscar ratings were down, but it was still something like 32 million people. I think the highest number watching a debate was maybe 24 million for the first Republican debate. Right. And it's gone down since then.
Your numbers are generally accurate. And let's think about it. The Oscars are basically which British actor you've seen in one or two films before is going to get a little gold statue.
Right.
Yeah.
And there'll be some performances,
the audience,
right?
The biggest debate audience of ever. So
there'll be the, you know, you tune in for the monologue, you tune in maybe for the Song of the Year nominees to be performed. I mean, I it's all theoretical to me. I haven't watched the Oscars in I don't know how many years, but when I became a dad and 90% of my movies became animated, there was really only one category that I was well versed in.
No, they got robbed in that one.
Exactly.
Man, you know,
exactly.
Movie, you know.
So the Oscars became much less important to me over that period of time. And maybe as my kids get older, I'll start to get back into it. But, you know, it is interesting. I mean, Andrew Breitbart said that politics is downstream from culture. And I think that is very much the case. I want to ask you about something that you wrote about today. I've not had a chance to read this, but this sounds, again, akin to conversations that you and I have had on many occasion here, that it's not just that we're seeing this crack up on the right, which the media loves to focus on and loves to talk about. But we are also seeing a deep divisional split on the left as well, which the media really doesn't want to highlight right now. But it's important for those of us who are, you know, Americans who like to pay attention to what's going on in this country. We should be aware that these fractures and these divisions are occurring all over the place.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to go through it and observe that, yes, you know, this is a Republican Party that is, you know, could argue coming apart. It was just very deep divisions that if you're a Rubio fan, you see Trump as just an abomination, and you see Ted Cruz as a maybe policy-wise acceptable, but persona-wise a very tough lift and not very appealing. If you're a Cruz fan, Rubio looks to you a lot like the establishment, everybody who wasn't willing to stick with Ted Cruz when he was leading his filibuster and his efforts and the government shutdown against Obamacare. And obviously you see Trump as somebody who doesn't understand the Constitution. If you're Trump, you see both of these guys as part of the system, part of the establishment, and guys who are not going to go and shake things up in Washington the way you do. What's gotten less attention and probably ought to get more attention is this split on the Democratic side. And it's not just a mere matter of, oh, you know, they prefer one candidate or another. You actually look and talk about the way Sanders voters talk and the way Hillary voters talk. They actually, you know, there's a very big distinction there. Maybe some of us on the right don't like thinking about the idea that there's different branches of the Democratic Party or that we might prefer one or the other. You could probably even argue that from a traditional conservative perspective, they're equally bad or equally problematic. One being that, look, the Hillary is the establishment of sorts of the Democratic Party, maybe the closest thing you get to a status quo of the Obama administration. This is where you'll find probably the most passionate advocates of gun control, the ones who are really worried about climate change. Campaign finance reform is a concern of both of them, but I kind of picture your wealthy urbanites and your wealthy suburbanites as your Hillary Clinton voters, folks who are perfectly comfortable with government, basically just want to see a more competent Obama administration. That's kind of the vision they have there. Then you look at the Sanders supporters. Look, the Sanders agenda is sweeping, right? I mean, it's going to be free college tuition, free, you know, health care through Medicare for everyone, right? You're going to have child care if you're a working parent. The government's going to subsidize that. Social Security, all the entitlements, big, expanded, more. And, of course, tax hikes are going to be way higher than they would be under Hillary administration, top tax rate of 52%, payroll tax. So it's a much bigger government vision. Sanders isn't kidding when he talks about himself as a political revolution. And it's, you know, like, even though we look at these Sanders solutions and say this is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, it's interesting to see Bernie Sanders talk about the problems of America. It does kind of overlap a bit with the conservative critique of Obama, kind of contending with a lot of economic happy talk. A lot of Americans are falling behind. People feel like they're more powerless than ever. There's kind of an interesting thematic similarity between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, even though they have very different policy perspectives.
Well, you know, we've talked with Bethany Bora, who's a conservative activist down in Florida and a college student, and she has said that on her campus, the sentiment is basically Bernie Sanders is the number one choice and Donald Trump is the number two choice of a lot of people, right? So you're right. There is the anti-establishment. There is the, I think earlier in the year, the phrase, the insurgent candidate, right? Bernie Sanders was the insurgent candidate on the left, and then there were a host of insurgent candidates on the right. But the mentality of, yeah, we know that this isn't the status quo. Yet we know that this is going to shake them. That's part of the point, right, is to rattle the cages of the establishment.
Yeah, and, you know, I one of the reasons, the argument you hear from Trump fans is he'll have crossover appeal. And I think some of us would say, yeah, because he's a Democrat. he is not somebody who goes on at great length about limitations on government and constitution and things like that. I don't think it's much of I don't think it's either an attack nor a praise of Trump to say that he wants to see an activist government. He talks about all, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, you know. He's not about limiting government power. He wants to see executive orders because he likes the Obama vision of the powerful presidency because he wants to step into it and, you know, fix things the way he thinks they ought to be fixed. And so the other point of this splitting the party into these five different groups or splitting the electorate into these five different groups is that it's not just that they have different priorities, different ideas, different, you know, philosophies that they want to see enacted. It's that each one of them sees the other four as really unappealing. There's just not much there for you in any of the other four. So, look, one way or another, there'll be a Democratic nominee. It's probably going to be Hillary Clinton. One way or another, there's going to be a Republican nominee. Odds are it's probably going to be either Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. But each one of them is going to be the choice of, let's say, slightly more than half of their party, right? There'll be a lot of people who will be frustrated. Whoever the nominee is, there's going to be a lot of frustrated Republicans and a lot of frustrated Democrats. And, yeah, they may hold their nose and vote for that figure in November, but I think the next president is going to end up having an exceptionally small mandate and very few Americans really believing that the person who got elected was the best choice because they were so frustrated by, the selection of the majority of their party.
You know, and I think that I think you're probably right, which ultimately may lead to, again, I'm not political Nostradamus, but you know, it could lead to a emboldened Congress reasserting the power and the authority of the legislative branch. Starting to
from
check
your
the
lips
power
to
of the
gods
executive.
And Congress's ears,
it could also lead to, fist fights in the Senate. We've seen that before in our nation's history, too. So, I have no idea which way this is going to go, but I do think it's interesting because, you talk about these five groups that the electorate has sort of split up into. Jeffrey Goldberg had an interview with Obama at the Atlantic. I was reading it earlier today. And apparently one of the things that Obama is very, very vocal about, he hates tribalism, he said, Jimmy. He hates the idea of, these groups just sort of nations breaking down into these very divisive groups. And I, as I'm reading this, that was my reaction, too. I'm like, well, what's happened over the last 7 years? If not, what are we seeing right now, if not the sort of emergence of the tribal mentality? In fact, I've said, during this election, I've kind of used the comparison that on the left, you have generally the collective versus the very disparate number of different tribes on the right, the three legs of the conservative stool, so to speak, that are now sort of kicking each other out of the way. And maybe that's the way that it has to be. If you are the party of if the one common denominator is individual freedom, right, and individual liberty, then maybe it is kind of hard to be that collective mentality where it's all about the common good, and you're expected to sublimate your opinion on some level, right, for the common good. So I think it's a little bit easier for the left to fall in line. Which is not to say that there won't be some disappointed Bernie Sanders supporters who would go vote Green or even Donald Trump if he's the nominee. But I think this is sort of baked into the cake. I think what we've seen, though, is that over the last 7 years, things really haven't gotten great in this country, Jim. The economy's not great for everybody. I keep hearing these reports that, the unemployment rate's down to pre-recession levels. But the job participation rate is not up to pre-recession levels. So what happens to those individuals who are still out of work, but they're not counted in the unemployment rolls anymore? Those forgotten Americans, there are a lot of people who 7 years in here, are not feeling. How many recovery summers have we had in a row now?
I think we're up to seven. And I think you're putting your finger on it that, some people were effectively forced to early retirement. Some of these folks went on to disability. Some people, took unemployment for as long as they could, and then unemployment ran out. Some went back to school. Some of this, when you see the workforce participation rate dropping, some of that is kind of the natural process of the baby boomers retiring. But, you look at wages, you look at people having, now that we're required to purchase health insurance or pay a giant fine by the government, now all of a sudden we're paying quite a bit in monthly premiums, and then we go see, oh, my goodness, I have giant co-pays and I have giant deductibles. I don't actually have any insurance. I paid a lot of money to carry a plastic card in my wallet all the time. Obama was supposed to fix things. And I kind of help feel like a big portion of this, and certainly the Sanders portion of this, is this belated recognition that none of his ideas really worked the way they're supposed to. The world doesn't feel safer. You mentioned the tribalism lament of President Obama. I don't know. You think having Al Sharpton be your point man on race relations might have been a bad mistake? You think we got to put, telling Latinos we have to punish our enemies might have been a bad mistake? Do you think, one of the reasons we on the right have said you're not supposed to play with identity politics, you're not supposed to stir these passions, you're not supposed to play to people's hates and fears is because you get a backlash. And everybody ends up angry and suspicious and paranoia about each other. And it's going to be very tough to get this genie back in the bottle, Cam. As I was laying that out there, these five different groups, I'm not even sure where the first part where you begin to put together an agenda that will unite at least two or three of them together into a coherent majority in some group that could get the country heading in the right direction again.
If I had the answer, I'd be the first one to tell you, buddy. I do think that it happens. I do think that we have seen these sort of splits and swirls in politics in our nation's history before. I said something on Twitter last night. I can't remember what story it was that I had retweeted, but I said it was about ISIS. And it was one of the latest atrocities where they're murdering children. And it's so sad that we can say that, matter-of-factly now. Oh, yeah, they're murdering children again. And I said, unfortunately, we're too busy fighting with each other than we are, eager to destroy ISIS. I think that, there is the idea that there are still external enemies out there who want to do all of us harm, whether we are Bernie Sanders supporters, Hillary Clinton supporters, Donald Trump supporters. There are people who want to murder us because we're Americans. There are people who want to see this country destroyed, who want to see our economy in shambles, who want to take down this country, all of us, because we're Americans. And maybe I hope it doesn't take it until all of our backs are up against the wall, fighting a common enemy for us to come together as a country again. But that might, in fact, be what it takes.
Yeah, I've always said the NRA News listenership doesn't feel like a show audience. It feels like family. And so here's a piece that I am working on right now. It is not finished, and let's just say it's even like halfway thought through. I hear people talking about, man, it's never been this bad. And you and I just went through the economic figures and workforce participation, and we laid out all the reasons people feel down. People feel frustrated. People feel angry. And they've got good reasons to be. What I'm kind of struck by are the number of people who are feeling despair, the number of people who describe themselves as enraged, and this kind of unofficial slogan of burn it down, right? The idea that things in America are so broken that they are unfixable. We might as well just tear everything that we have built, that our fathers built, that our grandfathers built, going all the way back to, Plymouth Rock, just burn it all down and start over. And I don't know whether that would entail a Mad Max-style eradication of civilization or what exactly these folks have in mind. But I'm sitting there, Cam, I'm going to borrow one of your favorite themes here. Our grandfathers went through the Depression and World War II. Our parents went through the Cold War. It wasn't that long ago we went through 9/11, right? And somehow, you look back, all of a sudden 9/11, like the late September, late 2001, almost feels like the good old days because everybody felt united in something. We all felt, you could look, every single person walking down the street, you're like, Al-Qaeda hates that guy as much as they hate me, and they're going to try to kill him, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do to protect that person, and that person's got my back too. Right? I mean, how is it that what was supposed to be one of our darkest hours looks really good now compared to what has been a 7-year recession, and you and I would probably argue a failed presidency or a presidency that's been exceptionally unproductive on a whole bunch of number of fronts. But how has this convinced us it's time to give up and start over when all these other challenges didn't?
That's an excellent question.
This is exactly the big philosophical questions you expected to talk about in your
program. This is why I love having you on. But so there's a line in that book behind me, Heavy Lifting, that, compared to our parents and our grandparents, we're snowflakes too,
mm-hmm.
right? No matter how tough we think we are compared to what our parents and our grandparents went through, we really do have it easy in a lot of ways. And was it Thomas Paine who said, that the things that come easy to us are the things that we don't really hold particularly dear, right? Because we don't know the cost. We drive on interstate highways. We, are able to check our news from our phone, but we don't have to put forth a lot of effort to do most of the things that we are. We don't have to put forth a lot of effort to enjoy the fruits of others' labor, whether it's someone in a foreign country making that iPhone or our forefathers who worked and created those interstate highways and, put the telephone lines up and things like that. We get to benefit from this. I think in some ways we are the luckiest people to ever have lived on this planet. I think in the aggregate, I really believe that. I think Americans are the luckiest people ever to have lived. But you get a little spoiled. You know, when we've had this period of success in our nation's history lasting from roughly, you know, 1945 until, you know, maybe what? When did things start to go south? Maybe after the dot-com boom in 2000, that's when things started, that kind of slow, gradual decline. So now we've had, but, you know, things have still been pretty good. We live exceptionally better than anybody has, or, you know, the top 1% of all humanity. That's where we get to live. But we don't see, Jim, we've always had that promise of things getting better, mm-hmm. right? That we're going to be able to keep building on these success stories. And now you look at people who are in their 20s, and they are making less than their parents did in their 20s. The roads of opportunity seem to be narrowing instead of widening. You know, if you, it used to be, honest to God, Jim, used to be in a, there maybe was a time where a theater degree wasn't going to consign you to working at a Starbucks the rest of your life. Because they're actually, you know, growing jobs in the theater industry. Now it seems unless you are working in the STEM industries, probably not much job growth, and even then you might be replaced by a robot in 10 years. You know, yeah. I think that there is that sense of despair because we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel in many cases.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess one of the things that we'd like to have a country that is less despairing in the face of adversity, and we've had adversity, right? I mean, you know, the collapse of the mortgages, the subprime market, layoffs of, you know, look, nobody's saying these problems don't exist. But I think you and I, you know, both on a personal level in our book, as we kind of look at this, you know, this furious, almost tenor of panic in our politics, which is kind of, you know, key perspective, right? If we've gone through past crises, we can get through this one. What is it about this one that's got people really feeling like, oh, they can't do it, and it's time for desperate measures?
But hang on, because it's also easy from our perspective here to not really know what was going through the minds of people in the 1930s. You know, that was the time of Huey Long and Father Coughlin, and, you know, there were a lot of people who were panicking and feeling despair, but we don't read their diaries. We don't read old newspaper stories. We forget about...
fascism, we have an idea of what was going through their head.
Right. But I think that we have seen that before. I imagine that, you know, in the panic of 1872, there's a reason why they called it the panic of 1872, because I imagine there are a lot of people panicking. You know, we are going through this in our own way, and we can read about what our forefathers did, but we can't experience what our forefathers experienced. So, you know, on the one hand, I want to cut us a little bit of slack, because things really are kind of crummy, and we need to recognize that things are kind of crummy. And when things are kind of crummy for a prolonged period of time, it's not uncommon for people to despair, particularly when you don't seem to see a way forward. Tyler Cowen had that book that came out a few years ago, The Great Stagnation. And, you know, have we broken through, or are we still in the Great Stagnation right now?
That's the end of the segment, right, Cam? We'll figure out tomorrow.
On that cheery note.
Yeah. I'm just making everybody, like, reach for hemlock at the end of my interviews these days. Sorry, I'm not my usual, you know.
Well, listen.
But we start out with Trump, Kanye. It doesn't get any funnier than that, so.
Look, I think that you are right about the most important thing that you said there, and that is that Americans are resilient. And we do get through things. And we have gotten through awful times in this nation's history before, prolonged periods of absolute awfulness that would make our hair curl if we really had to go through what our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had to deal with for years and years at a time. But we also need to be cognizant, I think, of where we are. And hopefully, you know, that awareness comes. And, it, you know, I don't know what it's going to take. It's probably a continuing process. But I have not given up hope, Jim. For the future of this nation, not by a long shot.
I'm glad, Cam. And let me, if anything can restore your hope and your faith in the future, it's a presidential campaign, right?
Absolutely.
Feeling better already.
Absolutely. Okay. All right, listen, you have a good week, and we will talk to you again very soon.
All right, looking forward to crossing paths with you, Cam. Take care.
Jim Garrity joining us from National Review. I feel like was Jim doing that segment from, like, his ledge? I think he's got a first-floor office, so it wouldn't be that big a deal, but... Kind of felt like I had to walk him back in there. All right, when we come back, we've got some headlines from around the country to get to, including a very cool opening in Colonial Williamsburg. Plus, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition. Stick around. There is much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Chris Vidgick with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website, but it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So So how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just published it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the Firearms Guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guide. First click, you click on a handguns. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel, let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Speaking with Eric Lipp with NRA Refuse to Be a Victim. Eric, welcome back to NRA News. What is Refuse to Be a Victim?
Refuse to Be a Victim is the NRA's crime prevention and awareness program. It teaches folks to create a strategy and to know different options they have and things they can do to keep them safe.
How does the program work?
Well, it's a seminar, so one would go on, search our website, find a seminar near you. And an instructor teaches a 2 to 4 hour seminar, goes over everything from cybersecurity, home security, physical security, automobile, travel, you name it. It covers a lot of topics, and it goes from there.
So this is about being safe. It's not just about using a firearm. It's other strategies for being safe.
Absolutely. It really doesn't involve firearms at all. We do cover some prevention devices such as pepper spray and other options that an individual could use. But a lot of it's more of, like I said, prevention topics. So what kind of locks you should use in your house, proper outdoor lighting, when to use the ATM. You know, do you go at night when it's late in a dark place, or do you go to say, I'm never going to go to an ATM. I'm going inside the bank and talking to the teller. So different lots of strategies and things you can do to just prevent ever being in a situation where you might be targeted. So we have a big section on phone scams, email scams, text scams, you know, every scam known to man these days. And so we try to do alerts. You know, there's been a lot with IRS sending fake, or not the IRS, but people sending emails pretending to be the IRS, pretending to say you drove through a toll and didn't pay it, or you missed a credit card payment, all sorts of different stuff. And then now we also have social media, so different ways to protect yourself. You know, don't people tell people you're out of town, where your kids are going that day, all sorts of different stuff that we talk about.
How do you get more info?
It's real easy. Go to our website, refuse.nra.org.
Eric Lipp, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition going to join us in a little bit, give us a legislative update. We've talked with Andrew Langer about this before, Colonial Williamsburg setting up a firing range, and it is ready to open now, Saturday, March 19th. They will be ringing in the educational musket range. I love this so much. Actually thinking about taking my kids on spring break here. WAVY says guests will learn from costumed interpreters about the history of flintlock weapons, particularly the ones used in colonial Virginia, their mechanics, use in hunting and defense, plus safety and proper handling. The range accessible only by ticketed guests by a shuttle from the Williamsburg Lodge. Admission includes instruction, safety equipment, firearms, ammunition, and targets. $119 available to guests ages 14 and older. So if you're planning on taking your kids to Colonial Williamsburg, something for the older kids there, children under the age of 18 must be accompanied by a parent or guardian, WAVY says. If you have not ever been to Colonial Williamsburg and you are a history buff, it is well worth your time if you are ever doing the Virginia tour of, you know, Mount Vernon and Monticello and things like that. Take a day. Say hi to Andrew while you're down there. But check out Colonial Williamsburg. It is absolutely fantastic. Meanwhile, up in Colonial Lexington, Massachusetts, actually I guess it's just Lexington, Massachusetts now. But, you know, one of the sites of the outbreak of the War of Independence, in Lexington, Mass., they're getting ready to hold their town meeting. And at this town meeting, there is a proposal to change a bylaw in the town to ban semi-automatic rifles and to ban magazines with more than 10 rounds. Robert Rotberg is presenting the citizens' petition. And last night there was a Board of Selectmen meeting there in Lexington where this was brought up. There's been apparently some effort by at least a couple of the selectmen to get Robert Rotberg to change this from a bylaw to something that, you know, doesn't really have any legal effect, more of a resolution that these things should be banned. Well, Caitlin Kelleher of Wicked Local in Massachusetts says hundreds turned out on March the 8th for a special meeting of the Board of Selectmen, most to express their opposition to a proposed bylaw that would limit the types of guns Lexingtonians can store in town. Most to express their opposition to this. Rotberg says that adopting such a bylaw would show that Lexington, through its elected representatives, is prepared to take another stand for liberty and against mass violence. Banning assault weapons, he said, does not infringe upon the right to own a gun in Lexington, only the right to own a weapon capable of many killings. Uh-huh. Dozens of people, Wicked Local says, almost all from Lexington, spoke out against the proposal, either as a bylaw or as a resolution. Again, most of the folks who showed up, they weren't out-of-towners. They were from right there in Lexington, which, I got to tell you, is not a big place. They weren't even coming from Concord. They were right there from the town itself. Michael Barg, who's a retired Navy captain, said, quote, it's an exercise in intellectual dishonesty. He said, there is no firearm problem in Lexington. He said, banning the guns listed in the proposal will not reduce the number of suicides or prevent crime. He said the proposal makes many of the legal gun owners in Lexington look like criminals. And he said, we certainly are not. But why would you want to own one of these rifles, sir? Many, according to Wicked Local, spoke out about the lack of a problem with gun violence in Lexington and said this bylaw would not address criminal actions. Frank Grex said, everyone knows that there is evil in this world, but you don't need a gun to do it. As everyone here knows, all you need is a pressure cooker, referring to the Boston Marathon bombers. Christopher Jong, veteran of the Army, 20-year resident of Lexington, said, after spending years defending other people's rights, I find it disheartening that someone wants to limit mine. And he said, please don't limit my rights. Wicked Local says a few members of the audience spoke in favor of the proposal. One of the residents who did speak up in support of the proposed gun ban, Cornelia Johnson, who said that she was struck by the number of people who love the town and who feel ownership of the green and those that stood on it April 19th, 1775. She said, I too feel ownership of the green. And I thought those men and those women were fighting for the safety and security of our families. And every day we see that security being put at risk. She said, I appeal to your conscience, your heart, and to you all as members of the family. You know, historically speaking, it should be noted that the good people of Lexington weren't demanding that the British come and take their guns from them. It was the opposite. Police Chief Mark Corr said he would not oppose a resolution, but he would have his officers enforce the state law before a local bylaw. He said, I would ask you not to put me in a position to tell you the law is not enforceable, and directing Lexington police officers to not enforce the law. He said, I do not want to speak of the irony of a bylaw intended to save a life may actually cost someone a life trying to enforce it. Selectman also released a 12-page analysis by the town's attorneys in response to a request to identify, quote, potential legal concerns with a ban on the manufacture, sale, and possession of, quote, unquote, assault weapons in Lexington. The lawyer said, well, look, the Supreme Court didn't review the case out of Highland Park, Illinois, which allows local municipalities to have gun bans like this. But they said, it doesn't mean that it can't be challenged in court, though. In part, it's a different circuit. And in part, the Supreme Court has not addressed this case, so it's still challengeable. Wicked Local says, if approved by the town meeting, the bylaw, like all others, would have to be reviewed by the state attorney general's office before it is enacted. But it kind of sounds like, again, based on who turned out last night, that there is not a lot of support for this. In fact, Wicked Local says at the end of the meeting, selectmen expressed their reservations even about the resolution as presented by Rotberg after saying that they would not support the bylaw change. Michelle Ciccolo, a selectman, said, at the moment, I find that the wording is too detailed and complex for town meeting. A sentiment echoed by Suzanne Berry. She said she'd be open to having more conversations about gun ownership, violence, and control, but she thought the town meeting could just get too caught up in the details of the resolution to have a productive conversation. Joseph Pato, another selectman, said he thought that this is something better taken up at the state level. He said, I'm not ready to endorse this resolution. I'm not ready to condemn it. I'd like to hear more of the arguments about why this resolution. Well, I imagine that if you have more public meetings on this, you will likely have more gun owners and maybe even a few of the supporters of this measure come and tell you why and why not. But congratulations and thank you to all of the gun owners there in Lexington, Massachusetts, who did show up for the Board of Selectmen meeting last night to speak up, stand up for your right to keep and bear arms. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, again, even in Lexington, Massachusetts, I know people may have written off Massachusetts, the anti-gunners, they're just all over the place there. There are a lot of gun owners in Massachusetts. Even in the, what does Jim Wallace call it, the battleground state of Massachusetts. Don't ever forget, particularly if you are lucky enough, blessed enough, or just smart enough to live in a state with fantastic gun laws, don't forget that even in those anti-gun states, there are plenty of folks out there who are fighting not just for their right to keep and bear arms, but they're fighting for your right, too. And, again, we saw a reminder of that in Lexington. All right, when we come back, Kurt Liske joins us from the Iowa Firearms Coalition. Stick around. We do have a lot more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on, she's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago, 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling a love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. Or this is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids,
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA Media Liaison, coming up next hour. We're going to talk about some lead ammo ban hearings in Minnesota, plus permitless carry in Georgia. Right now, I want to welcome from the Iowa Firearms Coalition, Mr. Kurt Liske is with us on the program. How you doing, Kurt?
Doing well, Cam. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, well, listen, there's more going on in Iowa, so thanks for being so productive there.
Well, when the session's over and we've got a couple bills signed into law, then we'll call it productive.
Right.
Regardless, thanks again.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming up today, I guess, right, House File 2314, which is carry permit reform. An Information Protection Act. This is before the Senate Judiciary Committee, or at least it was this morning?
Yes. In fact, we actually have a vote on it from a little bit earlier, less than about an hour ago. It actually passed 8-4 with one absence. So it is advancing. It will be available for debate and vote before the full Senate as whenever they will schedule it, which is, as you and I have discussed previously, Cam, has been an issue getting them to actually schedule this. So it's not a clear-cut win just yet, but it's encouraging. Now, we did today, there was an amendment that was tacked on, and it quite honestly is one that the Iowa Firearms Coalition is strongly opposing. I can kind of spell out the basics for you if you like.
Okay, before we get to the amendment, let's talk about what the bill itself does, the Carry Permit Reform Information Protection Act. So what is the reform and what information is protected here?
So the protection part is probably the most widely impactful portion of it. Right now in the state of Iowa, if you have a permit to carry, your information, anything that's on that permit, name, date of birth, et cetera, your address, all that good stuff, is all subject available via public record search, so FOIA searches, that sort of thing, of state records. Now, this has been a problem in the past for Iowans because what it does is it allows the media in Iowa to just basically do a big blanket, cast a wide net search for anybody that has a permit to carry, and then they will publish the names and personal information of permit to carry holders for no other reason than the fact that they're permit to carry holders.
Mm-hmm.
This has happened before. We've had numerous IFC members who have been singled out by employers because they have their permit to carry and have had various repercussions as a result of this. And in reality, they've done nothing wrong at work or in any other facet of their lives. So this would make that so that is not an option, basically. And then as far as the reform goes, it cleans up the permit to carry law that was passed in 2010. There's a few things. It would solidify online training for permit to carry and just kind of a language cleanup bill is probably the best way to sum it up.
Okay.
As far as the non-permit or privacy protection portion.
All right, and it should be noted, Kurt, you know, the privacy portion of this bill, I mean, we've seen this in a number of states that have moved in recent years to protect the privacy of concealed carry holders. Arkansas passed a similar language last year that became law in Virginia a couple of years ago. It wasn't a perfect fit or a perfect fix, but you now have to go to the individual county courthouse as opposed to the Virginia State Police, because we've seen exactly what you've described in the state of Virginia. We had a paper that published an online database of concealed carry holders, and there was a corrections officer who had a former guy that he had been in charge of show up at his house. You had a woman who had actually moved to Virginia, gotten a concealed carry license because her abusive ex-husband had said he was going to hunt her down and kill her, and she was outed. And so, you know, these are real individuals. There's a reason why this is a concealed carry license, and it kind of negates the concealed portion if you're publicly outed. So what is the amendment that was attached and that the Iowa Firearms Coalition is opposed to? What does this amendment do?
So what the amendment does is it requires a shooting, basically a proficiency test for permit to carry holders or anybody getting the permit to carry holder if this were to be signed into law. Now, there's a fundamental objection to that in that, you know, we have a Second Amendment right as Americans, and there's no reason why we should have to, prove ourselves in order to exercise that right. But that aside, and when you get into the actual language of the amendment, it requires a range test, but it would then greatly reduce the amount of training available to Iowans in that, okay, you have to take a classroom portion of the test, then you would have to go to a range. While that may sound great in theory, there's a lot of instructors that don't have access to ranges, and they do just strictly classroom work. And the way the amendment is written is that there's no way you could take, say, the classroom portion of your permit to carry process with one instructor and then follow it up with a second instructor for a range portion. So it is, again, the fundamental issues aside with, you know, just being, you know, the right to keep and bear arms, just the logistics side of this thing is not well thought out. It was a hastily put together amendment that was realistically, it was filed in essentially the 11th hour, and it's an effort, we believe, to try and water down this bill and get us to settle for something that had actually, I mean, overwhelming support in the House. So, like I said, the Iowa Firearms Coalition strongly opposes this for a number of different reasons.
All right. Well, the next step, as you say, is the Senate floor here, and I realize that there was sort of a legislative deadline that had to be met. These bills had to pass out of committee by tomorrow in order for the Senate to hear House proposal. So that happened. Will the Senate then have an opportunity to strip out this amendment in their vote?
This goes, yes. The amendment is then put before the entire Senate, and then basically it's up to each senator to make their own determination. There was no recommendations made by the Senate Judiciary Committee or anything of that nature. So this will literally come down to each and every senator in Iowa deciding to vote up or down on this amendment, and then they'll vote up or down on this amendment, and then depending on that, that will obviously play into, you know, how they vote on the bill as a whole. So,
all right. So the bill is House File 2314. If folks want to contact their state senator, and now would be the time to do it, right?
That's right. We've actually got three bills that are now eligible for votes in the entire Senate. Espresso legalization bill, the bill you and I were just discussing, Cam, and then an ATV carry bill, which would allow folks to carry while riding ATVs, snowmobiles, et cetera. And, yeah, now is the time to get active because all of these bills are very much alive. But the thing is, there are a couple of amendments that again, that are not good for these bills. They're not good for the Second Amendment advocates here in Iowa. And our senators absolutely need to be hearing about this early and often, as they say.
Right. Well, you can only vote once, but you can certainly send emails, make a phone call. Be polite and be respectful. You want to get your point across, but you want to let them know that, that you're out there, that you're a voter, and that this is an issue that you're paying attention to.
Bingo.
All right, Kurt, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program, sir, and keeping us updated as to what's going on in Iowa. I look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Likewise. Thanks again, Cam.
You bet. Thank you. Kurt Liske with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Again, the legislation there in Iowa, House File 2314. And coming up next hour, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report says the emails are not going away. And I don't even need to tell you what emails, because you know exactly what emails I'm talking about, right? It was interesting last night. I did not watch the Democratic debate. I am planning maybe on watching the Republican debate tonight. I have plans to, but you never know what happens when you come home and you got to help kids with homework and whatnot. But I was following along on Twitter a little bit on the Democratic debate last night and saw that in response to the question to Hillary Clinton, if you're indicted, would you step down as a candidate? Which, you know, I mean, that's a fairly clear-cut question. You didn't really get a clear-cut answer. You got a very Clintonian answer. Why? I it's not going to happen. I'm not even going to answer that question. I didn't send or receive any emails that were marked as classified. Now, again, I have no idea what's going to happen here. What the FBI will recommend and what DOJ will do. Those, by the way, two distinct and different steps in the process. FBI makes its recommendation. DOJ decides whether or not it will follow through with the FBI's recommendation or not. But as Peter Roth says, if the pattern of denial seems at all familiar, it should. It was honed to a razor's edge over 8 years when the Clintons last talked by the White House. It starts with an indignant rejection that any wrongdoing occurred. and that to suggest otherwise is to play into the hands of the former first couple's political opponents. That's followed by a grudging admittance that while perhaps something happened, it was A, all a mistake, B, nothing serious, and C, certainly not something that rose to the level of dishonesty that the first couple's political opponents had been suggesting. Yeah, that's kind of playing the script, isn't it? I'll talk with Peter Roth about that next hour. We have the hero of the day coming up at the top of hour three, but coming up at the top of hour two here in just a couple of minutes, we've got another armed citizen story that I want to talk about down in Vicksburg, Mississippi, where a escaped murderer went into the wrong home and took the wrong family hostage. A story that is unfolding here. We'll give you what we know. Coming up at the top of hour two, also continuing to pay attention to the latest Second Amendment news and information from around the country. So we have more legislative updates for you coming up in the hours ahead. Also, Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right, Stephen Cruiser joining us in hour three. And we'll even talk more about suppressors, this time not in the United States, but in Australia. Believe it or not, this is one of those stories. You know, the anti-gun activists, they love to talk about Australia. They're not going to want to talk about this story. They're going to just leave this one aside because it's not good news if you're an anti-gun advocate, because Australia is taking a page from the United States when it comes to suppressors. Stick around. We've got much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, on the way right after we're back from this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Michael Thaw of Crimson Trace. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good, John. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks for being back here on NRA News. All right, so ran into you here. You've got a really cool new product to show us. Tell folks, what is Crimson Trace? What do you guys do?
Crimson Trace is a laser siding manufacturer out in the Portland, Oregon area. We make more than 200 laser siding systems for firearms. We also make military siding hardware.
How does Crimson, give us a quick story of how Crimson Trace came about as a company.
Came up with an idea from our founder, Lou Danielson, and then that was more than 20 years ago. We've been in business that long, and the product lines have evolved since then. So it was a concept he had, and he just grew it into what today is known as Crimson Trace, the
right.
Great American story.
And I'll tell you what did you mention before we went there? What, over 200 product lines?
Over 200 products. We have red and green laser siding systems now.
It's awesome. And I'll tell you what, Michael, when you talk to people in the industry, in shooting sports competitive, no matter what, it's one of those names, Crimson Trace is, you know, everyone knows about it. You talk about having a strong brand.
One of the reasons we have so many products, we listen to customers. We know that a lot of NRA members are current customers, and we listen to what customers ask for or suggestions, and that's where the product base grows from.
And you also mentioned something about NRA members.
Yes. All of our employees are also NRA members. We pay the membership for the ones who don't join on their own, but we're all 100% NRA.
And it's so awesome, Michael, when a manufacturer understands that we're all in this fight together.
And they enjoy also getting the magazines and their hats.
I love it. Speaking with Michael Thaw, and he's the public and media relations manager for Crimson Trace. All right, so show us what you got, my friend. What is this?
Okay, this year we're known also for innovation. We've come up with a wireless system. The module is activated by the grip. So you can take your standard AR rifle grip off, and as long as your gun also has a rail somewhere on it, you can attach the module. So this grip is paired with that sight. So it's a laser and a light. So you can activate it this, and it's... There's more than 256 different signatures and codes that those two pieces of equipment communicate with, so there's no hacking it or no problems or anything else. So it's a wireless system designed by Crimson Trace.
Laser and a light and a wireless system, pretty cool stuff. So tell folks, what's the advantage of having a system like this?
It leaves you've got one hand that's control of your firearm. You've got the other hand that's free. You don't have to keep reaching up. You don't have to worry about wires. You don't have to worry about cables or anything else that's getting snagged on anything if you're moving through either the brush or a building or anything. So we know that This has hunting applications for people who are pursuing pigs and coyotes, and then it also has home defense applications. And we are growing the number of modules and the options that will be available, but it will all be controlled by the grip, the pistol grip.
It has applications here with the NRA News Crew. As soon as you broke it out, we're showing to everyone, just about everybody here wants to get one.
Folks are lined up at the booth also looking at it. And yesterday at the range, we had an event, and people were lined up and just, you know, let me see this. We've heard all about it.
Let me see it. Let me have one.
Let me have one is the big request.
Michael Fall with Crimson Trace. How can folks get more information about Crimson Trace?
Obviously, crimsontrace.com. is the fastest way to get information. And then we also have more than 2,500 dealers across the U.S. So most gun ranges and gun shops sell our products. They can go in there and look at a catalog, or they can call 800-442-2406 and request a catalog. We'll send a free one. The website's also a store. They can buy stuff there. We know that all dealers don't necessarily stock all 200 products.
Michael, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Starts right now. Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA media liaison, will join us later on in the hour. Excuse me. We'll discuss some hearings in Minnesota on a proposed ban on lead ammunition. Also, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report will join us later on in the hour. His latest piece, the emails are not going away. But before we talk with Catherine and Peter, you know, coming up in about an hour, we'll have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day. This story seemed worth highlighting on its own. Vicksburg, Mississippi, the Vicksburg Post. 8 days after he escaped from the Warren County Jail, Raphael McLeod's luck ran out, the paper reported. The 34-year-old McLeod found dead about 7 a.m. Thursday in the tub of a bathroom of a home that he broke into, shot by the homeowner. His death ends a round-the-clock search for him that began March the 2nd when he overpowered a jail guard and managed to slip out a side door at the jail. Warren County Sheriff Martin Pace said, quote, "This is certainly not how we wanted this to end. Our goal was to take him back into custody and have him stand before a jury in Warren County, but he brought this upon himself." The sheriff said, "We are incredibly relieved that his family was not seriously injured and they were able to protect themselves this morning. It's been a long week for this community," the sheriff said, "and we appreciate the cooperation of the public as we have pursued this offender." The police chief there in Vicksburg, Chief Walter Armstrong, said authorities think McLeod had help while he was on the run. Chief said he had on tennis shoes, nice white tennis shoes, and on a pair of blue jeans. So there's some indication that someone had been helping him or he stole those items, but the shoes look to be the exact size that he wears. The Vicksburg Post said that Raphael McLeod was shot several hours after he broke into a home in the 600 block of Ford Hill Drive. It was around 4 o'clock this morning. He fought with the homeowner and his wife, and he held them hostage until the husband was able to get free, was able to retrieve his firearm, and shot Raphael McLeod. The husband was stabbed in the struggle, suffering a non-life-threatening stab wound. He was taken to a local hospital for treatment. His wife was hit in the head during a fight with Raphael McLeod, but did not have to go to the hospital, thankfully. The chief there in Vicksburg said that McLeod actually gained entry through to the home through an unlocked door. Apparently, the husband had gotten up, had gone out to the garage, was getting ready to start his wife's car, and that's when Raphael McLeod attacked. The man and his wife both fought McLeod before he was able to subdue him, according to the chief. He said the couple tied up, but the husband managed to break loose, go get his gun, and shot McLeod. Raphael McLeod, by the way, was awaiting trial on capital murder and other charges in a June 28th abduction and death of a woman named Sharon Wilson. It was early on the morning of March the 2nd when he escaped from jail. He used a shank to assault and overpower one of the three guards on duty there at the jail at the time. There was a massive law enforcement presence looking for him for the past week. He had been in the Warren County Jail since his arrest on June 29th. McLeod indicted in January on multiple counts involving the death of Sharon Wilson. Vicksburg Post said he has prior felony convictions as well for auto burglary, grand larceny, and armed robbery. So Raphael McLeod could have been one of our deals of the day as well. But, again, I thought this was an armed citizen story worth noting, where a individual able to come to the defense of his family and himself with the help of his firearm. Do you think, by the way, that we'll see much news of this in the national media? Maybe we will. But I wonder if we will see. NBC News has it 33 minutes ago. A family being held hostage by a suspected murderer fatally shot him Thursday morning in the multi-agency manhunt for the armed and dangerous felon. Armstrong telling the Associated Press the man and his wife managed to grab a gun, and one of them shot McLeod during the hours-long struggle. The woman and a child inside the home were unharmed, according to WLBT. So, again, maybe we will actually see this story gain some national prominence. I hope so. Because, again, often stories like these stay local stories. They don't gain that that national prominence. But here you have a sheriff who, as he said, this isn't how they wanted this to end. They wanted to apprehend this guy. They wanted to take him back into custody. They wanted to put his rear end on trial. They didn't want this man and his wife to be held hostage. They didn't want them to be assaulted. They didn't want this guy to have to be able to get his gun and shoot his attacker. Again, they're glad that he was able to, but that's not how law enforcement wanted this to go. But again, the sheriff noted he was glad that this individual was able to protect himself and his wife and his child. And I wonder how many anti-gun activists out there, I don't think any of them would consciously say, well, you know what, I think it's awful that he had a gun. But how many anti-gun activists, I wonder, are pushing for a culture and a society in which this guy and his wife would be shamed for being gun owners? How many of these anti-gun activists are pushing for laws that would make it more difficult for this man and his wife to exercise their right to keep and bear arms in their home? For self-defense, legally carrying for self-defense. You know, in Maryland, there was a hearing on several anti-gun bills yesterday. And one of the lawmakers, A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart, picked this up. One of the lawmakers there in Annapolis, Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Montgomery County, said that he and his colleagues will not stop pushing gun control until they have an annual, quote, death toll of zero in the state. He said, we're going to stop when we get to a death toll of zero in the state of Maryland. That's when we're going to stop. Now, keep in mind, the last big push for gun control legislation in Maryland was signed into law in 2013. By then-Governor Martin O'Malley. And since then, homicide rates have skyrocketed in Maryland's biggest city there in Baltimore. A 20-year high in 2015. And I don't think that any of the individuals who were apprehended and charged with a homicide there in Baltimore, Maryland, were legal gun owners. I certainly don't think they were concealed carry holders. Again, most of these individuals have a rap sheet as long as my arm. And the presence of an additional law on the books, which again, this law aimed at the law-abiding Marylanders, doesn't impact that individual. Because we're talking about enforcement of the laws at this point. You know, the senator can say, well, we're not going to stop. We're going to stop when we get to a death toll of zero in the state of Maryland. Well, if you think you're going to get there by passing gun control law after gun control law, you're going to be there in Annapolis for a long, long time. Well, unless the voters vote your rear end out. Because you can't gun control your way out of this problem in Maryland. It's not a matter of passing another law. It's a matter of actually dealing with the individuals who are committing these violent crimes. And how many times in Baltimore, Maryland, do you find somebody who is committing a disproportionate amount of violent crime, who has that rap sheet, again, that runs to several pages at a very tender age? And how many times does that individual get a plea bargain, do the minimum amount of time, have the charges nulled, have them hanging over his head, and have a prosecutor or a judge say to him, listen, you stay on the straight and narrow or else we're going to bring these charges, and then maybe that doesn't happen either? If you can legislate your way out of this problem by just passing reams and reams of gun control laws, you're deluding yourself. Even worse, you're deluding the voters. You know, it's going to take real effort. You want to bring the violent crime rate down in Baltimore, Maryland, it's going to take some actual effort. It's going to take supporting law enforcement. It's going to take people working at multiple levels in a very dysfunctional city right now. It's going to take a lot of hard work from real individuals, including some elected officials, including some bureaucrats. It's going to take working with the community, not lecturing the community. But it's not going to take another gun control law. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, if you were to perhaps, again, start empowering residents there in Baltimore and the rest of the state to be able to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. If violent criminals in Baltimore, Maryland suspected that their targets may actually be a concealed carry holder, maybe they would be less likely to commit armed robberies there in Baltimore, Maryland. But right now, you don't get a concealed carry license in Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, because you live in a bad neighborhood and you want to carry for self-defense. That's not a good enough reason to exercise your constitutional right to bear arms. So again, if God bless you if you live in Maryland, because you've got a lawmaker there who is pledging to rush headlong into the wrong direction for as long as it takes to bring the violent crime rate down to zero. And the way he thinks he's going to do that is by going after your right to keep and bear arms. Again, maybe I guess the idea is that, what, you get back to where nobody can own a gun legally, and then we'll get to zero? Is this lawmaker who lives in Montgomery County, has he ever taken a look at what happened in Washington, D.C. when they passed their gun ban? It didn't go down to zero. Maybe they don't maybe he never learned that in school, Cameron. Maybe he was learning other things. They just never had a civics lesson on what actually happened there. I'm positive they never had a civics lesson on what happened in Washington, D.C. after they banned firearms in 1977. I'll guarantee you they're not teaching that in the D.C. schools or in the Montgomery County schools or Fairfax County up there in Northern Virginia. He's not be discussed.
I would say he's probably, you said if he's taking a look at what's happening in D.C., I would almost bet the house that he's one of the Blame Virginia guys.
Oh, I'm sure, because that's what you do if you're an anti-gun politician in Maryland. You blame Virginia for Maryland's violent crime rate. That's your built-in excuse. And what's amazing is that I don't know how that actually works, because Virginia's violent crime rate, you know, is it's pretty low, all things considered. Latest numbers, 2014. Our violent crime rate, 196.2 per 100,000. Our homicide rate, 4.1 per 100,000. This was of the 50 states. We were 46th in terms of violent crime, meaning we were the 46th most violent state. Maryland, on the other hand, violent crime a little bit higher in Maryland than it is in Virginia, which, again, you wouldn't think would be possible since Maryland has all those gun control laws and Virginia doesn't. But Maryland's violent crime rate, 446.1 per 100,000, a homicide rate of 6.1 per 100,000. Maryland in 2014 was the 10th most violent state in the country. Huh. Isn't that interesting? So Virginia, which again the anti-gunners like to blame for Maryland's violent crime, the 46th most violent state in the union. And we've got big cities, right? We've got urban areas. We've got Richmond. We've got Newport News. We've got Virginia Beach. We've got Northern Virginia. We've got population density. We don't have as much violent crime as Maryland does. And isn't it fascinating? I mean, nobody on the anti-gun side is ever really willing to acknowledge that or what that actually means. We are just supposed to accept that somehow violent criminals, maybe violent criminals from Virginia, drive into Maryland to commit their violent crimes, and then because they don't want to commit violent crimes in, you know, their backyard, and then they drive back to Virginia and they're just all happy-go-lucky. Or the violent criminals, Maybe Maryland just has more violent criminals per capita, and they all come down to Virginia and they load up, they back up the dump trucks to gun stores, and then they drive back up to Maryland and they commit violent crimes. I can't figure it out. Because if Virginia's gun laws were to lead to Maryland's violent crime rate, I can't understand why Virginia's violent crime rate wouldn't be higher than Maryland's, as opposed to being one of the safest states in the union. It is a conundrum, unless, of course, it's just nonsense from the anti-gun advocates, and it actually there is no reason why Virginia's gun laws would lead to more violent crime in the state of Maryland, while it leads to less violent crime in the state of Virginia. All right, stick around. We have got to take a quick time out, but when we come back, Catherine Mortensen's going to join us, NRA ILA media liaison, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report later in the hour as well. Stick around. We'll be right back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club. But we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain
body types. A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others, it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun. Thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us. But thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
We're here at the NRA World Shooting Championship here at the Peacemaker Range out here in West Virginia. And I was able to grab Dennis Willing. He's the director of the NRA Competitive Shooting Division for like 2 seconds because he's so busy here. Dennis, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
Thank you, John. I'm doing well.
Well, this is just a good sort of a starting point here, because just to give folks an idea, NRA Competitive Shooting Division, you guys are everywhere doing everything. Give us an idea of the scope and breadth of what the Competitive Shooting Division gets into.
Well, we get involved in all kinds of events, from the standard rifle, pistol, and small bore events. That's our traditional games. We're branching out now. We've been supporting the PRS, the Precision Rifle Series. We've been looking at that. But this World Championship thing came along a couple years ago. Last year was the first year, and we're in our second year now. And this entails many, many firearms and different sports. So.
And Dennis, it's been great. Well, you and I were talking off camera how when we first met each other at Camp Perry, but how not only how your role has evolved, but how the role of NRA Competitive Shooting Sports has evolved into new disciplines, new kind of competitions. It's really exciting.
It is, because we're always looking at and getting involved in more things and adding new games and using the newer firearms and new equipment that's coming out, changing the rules to keep abreast of technology and keeping our games going as much as possible. We've Action Pistol, for example, has been in existence for about 37 years. In our 38th year, we're going to have a major change to that event, and it's going to be bigger and better than ever, and we're hoping that a lot of people will come out and shoot that. It's a lot of fun.
I love it. How can folks get more information about your division?
Compete.nra.org.
Compete.nra.org. Dennis Willing, I know you're a busy guy. I'm going to let you get back to it. Thanks for what you do every day, sir, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much. Being part of the Competitive Shooting Division of the NRA is great fun.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News, Cam and Company. Peter Robb coming up from U.S. News and World Report later on in the hour. We have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, coming up top of Hour 3. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well. And right now I want to welcome to the program from NRA ILA Media Liaison Catherine Mortensen is with us. Catherine, how you doing?
Hi, doing great. Thank you so much, Cam.
Absolutely. It is a very, very busy time of year right now. We've got, I think, every state legislature, maybe except for Texas, which meets on every other year, they are all in session. You've got bills going through committee, being heard on House floors. And up in Minnesota, they're getting ready to hold hearings on a proposed lead ammo ban. Is that right?
Right. That's coming up tonight. And we want to get the word out to our members and supporters in Minnesota that the State Department of Natural Resources is considering banning traditional ammo. So, or maybe you've heard the term lead shot. That's what they want to do away with, and they call it the farmland zone of the state's managed land. And we're trying to get the word out that this is not based on sound science, and this would put a huge, I mean, it would be very difficult and be very burdensome to the hunters in that state.
Absolutely. You know, and this push goes back a number of years. We saw this in California. And the original idea was we were told this was going to save the California condor, that they were ingesting lead shot. They were dying of lead poisoning. So that we had the lead ban put in place in the California condor zone. And that was expanded statewide. Then they tried to push in Arizona. Then we saw the Center for Biological Diversity decide that they wanted to try to ban lead shot, lead sinkers nationwide. That effort apparently failed at the federal level, although we do have it's still sort of a live issue. I know we've got legislation that would prevent the EPA from banning lead shot that's in Congress right now. But it seems like now, Catherine, they're back to trying to do this state by state.
Right. That is where they're finding more traction, these anti-gun types, is at the state level. And the bottom line is, at least in Minnesota, there is no sound scientific evidence that traditional ammunition is having a population level impact on the species in Minnesota. That's any species. So our point of view here at the NRA is that we want to ensure that there's the proper conservation of species and wildlife, but it must be done with fact-based approach and sound science. A lot of times these efforts are driven by fringe, radical, you know, sort of animal rights groups. Then they're definitely not using sound science that has been shown to be effective in managing wildlife and conservation.
You know, it wasn't too far from Minnesota. I think it was North Dakota where a few years ago, Catherine, you had a veterinarian, and he x-rayed some venison with lead shot and said, ah, see, look, you know, there's lead shot all over the place. I think it was the CDC, right, or the National Institute of Health came in to North Dakota.
Right. I do remember some of this.
Mm-hmm. And they did testing of the lead levels of blood in those who ate wild game and those who do not eat wild game there in North Dakota, along with the North Dakota Health Department. And what they found was that the levels of lead in the blood was actually higher for those who were not eating wild game, those who were not hunting, and those who were not eating, you know, the doe that mom or dad brought back. The people who are actually eating the wild game had lower levels of lead in their blood, which would, again, kind of indicate that this is not a health concern here.
No, and it's not based on science. And, in fact, we even have a smoking gun, so to speak, in Minnesota, where an official with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Jason Abraham, he was quoted in the Star Tribune last fall. And literally he says, quote, "There is no new evidence lead shot is causing problems on state wildlife areas." So in their own words, they acknowledge that this is not causing problems for the wildlife. So that leads us to conclude that if they're not basing these proposals on sound science, they must be driven by some other agenda. And typically it is an anti-gun, anti-Second Amendment agenda.
All right. So where are these hearings being held tonight, Catherine?
Sure. So it is in St. Paul, Minnesota, or rather, let me get that right. It's tonight from 6 to 9, yep, in St. Paul. It's at the Department of Natural Resources headquarters building. So that's downtown in St. Paul, Minnesota, 6 to 9 tonight.
Okay. And do we have any idea, the vote won't be taken tonight, will it?
No, because they're going to take written comments as well, so no decisions will be made tonight. But we just want to get as many of our supporters there mm-hmm. to have their voices heard and put in those written comments.
Absolutely. This is, you know, if you don't use your voice at moments like this, you know, that's this is when it's actually critical to get there and speak up and speak out. And if you can't get there in person, as you say, there's a written comment a period that'll be taking place. But it's always good when you can, you know, speak face to face with the folks who are making these decisions.
Absolutely. We've found that when our people get out and have their voices heard, it does make a difference.
Absolutely. Again, we're talking with Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA media liaison. Now, while we've got you here, Catherine, let's also talk about what's going on in Georgia, because, boy, it seems like that's a very busy legislative session, too.
Right. So tomorrow, the Senate in Georgia is going to vote on what we're calling a campus safety bill. Others are calling it a campus carry bill, but in truth, allowing adults in college who have concealed carry licenses to carry those firearms on campus is a campus safety bill. We have seen that these types of measures in other states have made campuses safer. So we are pushing for this to pass in the Georgia Senate tomorrow. It already passed with strong bipartisan support in the House, and Governor Deal in Georgia has indicated he supports this measure. But as you know, in these legislative processes, it can be very dicey. So we don't count anything as done until it's actually signed. So we're asking our supporters to contact their state senators in Georgia and support this campus safety bill. And hopefully it'll get passed and make it to the governor's desk.
Absolutely. And so what should gun owners be doing right now to help this bill along, Catherine? Would now be a time to contact their state senators?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Contact their state senators in Georgia and urge them to support. I'll give you a bill number. It's House Bill 859. We're calling it the Campus Safety Bill. It would allow those law-abiding citizens in Georgia who have a Georgia weapons license to carry while they're on campus. And in Georgia, you have to be 21, so these are adults. Mm-hmm. And we have plenty of evidence that shows that concealed carry individuals nationwide are more law-abiding than the rest of the population by far. So these individuals are not causing problems or mayhem on college campuses. In fact, here's one fact that I think our supporters ought to remember if they do speak with their senators. Since becoming legal, and there's 8 states that have campus carry provisions, since becoming legal in these states, a lawfully possessed firearm has not been used to commit a murder on a campus.
Really? So yep. all of the hype and all of the fear-mongering that we see here, I'm going to be afraid to talk about a book in class because our opinions are going to be chilled. None of that has actually happened.
Not seen it. In fact, in Utah, the University of Utah, after they began allowing students to carry a concealed firearm more than a decade ago, mm-hmm. the campus experienced a drop in the rates of violent crime, forcible rapes, and aggravated assaults. We know that students are safer on a campus that allows law-abiding gun owners to protect themselves, their fellow students, and even their professors. And as you know, Cam, in many cases, it's these professors and administrators who are most opposed to this. But the fact is, they are actually safer on a campus where law-abiding students are allowed to carry. In most cases, they have a concealed carry permit, and mm-hmm. they're 21 years old.
You know, and it's interesting because in Georgia specifically, I mean, we've seen robberies at the library at Georgia State. They actually had to shut down the library, Catherine, because of all of the robberies that were happening inside the library on campus. The blogger Instapundit Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at the University of Tennessee, was talking on his blog yesterday. His daughter went to Georgia Tech, and when she was a freshman, they actually had a series of armed robberies of students there in the dorms. And Glenn wrote to the university president expressing his concern as a parent of a student, said he never heard a word back from the president about this. So as you can imagine, I think Glenn's awfully happy about the prospect of his daughter's a little bit older now, possibly being able to carry for herself protection there on the campus.
Well, that's an unfortunate situation. And we know we've got the numbers to back it up that there at the University of Utah, they saw a drop in the forcible rapes, the rate of violent crimes, and aggravated assaults. All of those things went down after students were allowed to conceal carry at the University of Utah.
There you go.
That's been more than 10 years.
Yeah, I know also as well Colorado State, it's been a couple of years since I've looked at the crime stats, but I know in the first, I think, 5 years after campus carry was passed in Colorado, the number of reported crimes on the campus of Colorado State dropped from, I think, 800 a year down to about 200 a year. And none of those 200 were committed by concealed carry holders. So you're right. I mean, the evidence that we have, we don't have to rely on hyperbole. We don't have to talk about theoretically what could happen because, as you say, we've got 8 states that we can actually look at, and we can uh-huh. see that the predictions of a Wild West mentality on campus, they don't come true. We're talking, again, as you said, about the very same people who are currently carrying off campus, and they're responsible, safe gun owners.
That's exactly right. And really quick, if I could make a point, in Georgia, Michael Bloomberg with his Everytown USA group has gone into the state, and they're blanketing the airwaves down there with ads opposing this campus safety bill. And it made it through the House and the Senate committee despite all of Bloomberg's money. And we are really hoping that we will have a victory tomorrow in the Senate just to kind of show Bloomberg that the people of Georgia will not be misled by his lies. His group is down there spreading misinformation, as you said, and we think that the people of Georgia are smarter than that.
Well, I think that you are right, Catherine, but another sign that Bloomberg might not be running for president, but he certainly wants to play a big role in the elections this year, so we can't let up our guard.
Absolutely, and thank you so much, Cam, for letting us get the word out on this.
Yeah, always a pleasure, and I hope we can talk again soon. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you, Cam. Okay, bye.
Catherine Mortensen, NRA ILA Media Liaison, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Greenville, South Carolina. Two Pickens County men accused of entering a Clemson University apartment and robbing a victim over the weekend. Winthrop, they had an armed robbery of a student there on Winthrop last week. Petitions started to increase campus safety. The school apparently has responded. They are going to add an emergency call box there on the campus. So that should take care of any crime, right? Don't have anything to worry about now. We've got a new call box that's been installed. Yeah. We will be paying much more attention. Actually, I shouldn't say much more attention. We've been paying attention to the campus carry debate in Georgia, but we will continue to pay attention to the campus carry debate in Georgia. And again, looks like tomorrow could see a vote on House Bill 859 again in the Georgia State Senate. At the Atlantic, there was a piece yesterday by Ian Bogost, The Armed Campus in the Anxiety Age. Now, Ian is a professor there at Georgia Tech, where Glenn Reynolds' daughter, the Insta-daughter, went to school. And he said, a while back, a student there at Georgia Tech showed me a series of anonymized threats that students at a notoriously difficult class of mine had posted in an online discussion forum. Ian says, I just returned grades and nobody was happy. Does he have kids, one asked. I'm going to steal them and blackmail them. Blackmail them, answered another. Had kids, added a third. Ian says, they're the kind of comments you wouldn't think twice about, just typical college students communing over a tough professor. Unless, that is, you also knew that those students might be permitted to carry concealed firearms on campus, then their words might take on a different tenor, even if just hypothetically. Really? I'll be honest with you, as a dad here, if I saw a series of comments like this, does he have kids? I'm going to steal his kids and blackmail him. Oh, he had kids. I'll tell you, my concern, I don't think, would be exacerbated or ratcheted up based on whether or not my campus allowed campus carry. Because I really wouldn't be worried about the concealed carry holder coming and kidnapping my children. If I was going to be concerned about these threats, and I'll be honest with you, if I saw a series of comments like that, I might be a little concerned. I might actually think about protecting my family. Not, oh my goodness gracious, we can't allow campus carry. Because it seems to me that if somebody were serious about, I don't know, kidnapping your children, which is already against the law, they're not likely to be a law-abiding, responsible concealed carry holder. Yeah. We'll talk more about this piece of the Atlantic. It's worth delving into because this is, look, there clearly are a lot of professors, a lot of educators on college campuses right now who do not want to get educated on this issue. And they do not want to think critically about this issue. So as a public service, we'll help them along. But when we come back after a quick timeout, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report says Hillary Clinton's email issue is not going away. We'll be back with more. We're not going away either. In fact, we'll be back right after this here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Here at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we're here with Adam Whitehead from the Sportsman's Box. Adam, thank you, sir, for coming on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is a really cool idea. My youngest are 10, and last year for their birthday, we got them this thing called Loot Crate, which is a subscription box. And I started thinking, man, I want something like that, but I want it for me. Like, I'm not interested in comic book stuff, things like that. And I, my eyes just lit up when I walked by your booth, because that's exactly what the Sportsman Box is, right?
Right. So it's like a, it's a Christmas present for any sportsman in your life or sportswoman in your life that, or for yourself, you know, that you can get every month. It's like Christmas every month.
That is awesome. So this is the January box that you've brought with you, right?
Correct. This is our January box. It just went out to our members all over the nation. We shipped all 50 states and Canada. So,
and so yes. This is representative of like what you'll get every month, right?
Correct. We try to make sure we do have 20 other field operatives throughout the nation. So they help us select gear to make sure that all the gear that we put in the box can be used through with by sportsmen all over the nation instead of just one specific general region.
How cool. So how did you guys come up with this idea?
Yeah, so I used to be in web design and kind of followed the whole tech industry and what's popular and saw that, you know, Loot Crate was doing it. I saw them doing it and said, you know what, is anybody doing this for us, for me? Because I'm a hunter and fisher myself, and I didn't see anyone doing it. And so I just kind of came up with the idea, built the website, and went to my business partner. His name is Will, and pitched the idea to him, and he jumped on board, and we've been full steam ahead ever since, so it's been a lot of fun.
I mean, and you guys have really taken off. April of 2015 was when you guys started this, right?
Correct, and we were only shipping to 48 states, and then we just had demand out of those other two states, Hawaii and Alaska, that we could make it happen. So
that is awesome. So you've been shipping since July of last year?
July of last year, yep.
Okay, and so kind of walk me through the box. I mean, what are some of the things that you guys have in the January box, for instance?
Yeah, so the January box is more of a classic box. We just kind of we put in the Stanley Thermos. Keeps your coffee hot, drinks cold. It's one-hand use. It's easy to throw in your hunting pack, and it's not going to leak unless you're pressing this button here.
Okay.
So Stanley comes out with some great products. They've been around since 1913, and they have lifetime warranty on all their products. So great item for any sportsman to have, obviously. The Outdoor Edge knife, another great tool. Great for skinning. You know, everybody could use another knife. It comes with a camouflage sheath, yet the knife is orange, so if it falls in the woods, you can find it easy. We have some Gear Aid Aqua Seal, which is some repair adhesive. If you get a cut in your boot, tear in your boot, put this over it, let it dry, becomes waterproof again.
Oh, nice.
Stuff like that. And the Tenacious Tape is a type of tape that you want to keep in your hunting pack. A lot of people don't know about this, but say if you get a cut in your coat while you're out in the field and you need a quick fix, throw this tape over it, makes it back windproof, waterproof, or whatever it was. And then, you know, something we like to do is, as sportsmen, we like to eat. I like to eat.
Right.
And so we
I
always,
like to eat too, Adam.
So we always want to put it like a field snack in there so they can enjoy while they're kind of going through their box. This January month was Pork Clouds by Bacon's Hair. So it's pretty much just a fried pork skin, but a lot better recipe than kind of what you find at the normal grocery store.
That's cool. So this is, again, representative of what you're going to get every month, but
correct,
you're going to get different things every month. So how do you find the items that you're going to put in your box each and every month?
Yeah, so we always cater towards the season ahead. So, and like I said, we use 20 other sportsmen around the nation in Canada to make sure that the items can be used by everyone. But we test gear. Companies will send us gear to test. We send it out to our field operatives and such. But you can expect anywhere from $65 to $75 worth of gear.
Okay, so the longer you get a membership, the cheaper the box becomes, right?
Correct. If you pay for 12 months up front, you're going to pay $35 a month, but you will pay for that up front as well.
Okay. This is awesome. So how can folks get you online?
You can just go to thesportsmansbox.com. I mean, it is really caught on. If you check us out on social media as well, at Sportsman's Box on Instagram, www.facebook.com/sportsmansbox, you'll see people posting pictures of their boxes, getting involved with it. It's just a lot of fun to kind of come home, see that sportsman's box sitting at your doorstep, say after a long hard day of work, and you know you're about to get a Christmas present, and it's going to be geared towards your lifestyle. It's not going to be socks or anything in it. So it's a great gift option, you know.
Welcome back to NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming to you today from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. It is absolutely gorgeous outside. I am
Almost recovered from the CPAC plague, though, so I'm still a little shivery and under the weather, so I'm bundled up. But it is like almost 80 degrees outside. It's absolutely beautiful. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report with us on the program right now. Peter, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So another week of debates for you. Is this one of those? Do you still? I guess I should ask. First of all, are you still watching all of the debates?
Bits and pieces.
I'm not even sure what we're up to now on the Republican side. I think this might be debate number 11 or 12.
11, 12, 13. Does it really matter?
Something like that, right? We had another one for the Democrats last night. You know, once again, Hillary Clinton's emails came up. As a matter of fact, she was asked, if you get indicted here, would you step down as a candidate? And, you know, she laughed it off. Peter said, ha ha, it's not going to happen. So I'm not even going to answer that question. But, you know, I think that's a very reasonable question, actually, for a Democratic voter to ask a candidate who is currently the subject of an FBI investigation, don't you?
It is a reasonable question, but she's banking on the fact that she's too big to jail. The problem is that she might be right. I've talked with a number of attorneys in the political sector, people who used to be assistant U.S. attorneys who are now defense lawyers, who say that, you know, there are all kinds of things that go into this calculation about whether to indict or not, whether to convict or not, and certainly the question of intent is one of those things that has to be considered. And so at the end of the day, I think that she's banking on the idea that they will find that while she did send classified emails through an unsecured server, while she hasn't been truthful about it in public, because she didn't intend to break the law, that she's not indictable. Would it be that you and I and every other American receive that kind of consideration from the justice system every time we did something that violated the federal rule someplace? But as I said, she's too big to jail. We're not.
Too big to jail is a scary phrase. I didn't like too big to fail, quite honestly, Peter. Too big to jail seems like a very un-American idea, doesn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. We're founded on, among other things, the principle that no one is above the law. But as we watched with her husband through that torturous impeachment and trial in the Senate and Paula Jones's legal case, that he was able to twist and turn the meaning of definitions to his advantage to a point where he escaped punishment. Everyone knows that I think that he did it. Everyone knows that he lied about it. Everyone knows that the way he treated Paula Jones in that hotel room in Arkansas was sexual harassment by most any accepted definition of the term at the time. But again, you know, he got away with it because the president of the United States is too big to jail.
One of the things that we have heard, and it's been nothing official, certainly, but there's no shortage of people speculating that if, in fact, something like this happened, that DOJ refused to indict, that FBI Director Comey and maybe other senior-level FBI officials would step down in protest. Are you still hearing any of that bandied about, Peter?
I guess people are still bandying that about, but I don't think that's informed opinion. I think that's just a guess. There's a legal dimension to this, but there's also a political dimension. What happens in the court of public opinion isn't necessarily the same thing happens in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you look at the Trump voter, when you look at the Sanders voter and how they're expressing their dissatisfaction with business as usual in Washington, the fact that she escapes indictment on some narrow definition that involves intent doesn't necessarily exonerate her in the minds of the American people. It may keep her out of jail, but it may also keep her out of the White House.
No, I think you're right about that. I mean, in fact, that would be an almost perfectly Clintonian ending to this story, right?
Yeah.
Where you do have a lot of people who think, well, something should have happened, and yet here again, she skates, a Clinton skates, and probably with a lot of I told you so's, and see, I'm as honest as the day is long type of rhetoric, which we've been hearing from Hillary Clinton, who, you know, could not even say, yes, I think that I'm honest. I don't think I've ever lied to the American people, Peter.
But remember that this whole thing started, as I wrote in my column on usnews.com last week, this whole thing started with, I wouldn't, I couldn't, I never would have, oh, that's absurd, mm-hmm. How can you accuse me? I never sent classified information over private email server. Now it's, well, maybe there was some information that went over the server, but it never went overseas, and we took precaution. And so the story changes. The story evolves as it is convenient for her to have it be at any given moment. She hasn't been candid. She hasn't apologized. She hasn't been forthright. I still want to know, frankly, why the private server? Who was it that she didn't want reading her email? Was it the Russians? Was it the Chinese? Or was it the people over in the Obama White House? And that is an interesting question.
Absolutely. Peter, listen, I appreciate you coming to the program, sir. It is always a pleasure, and I look forward to doing this again
always
very soon.
Always happy to do it, Cam.
Thank you, sir. Peter Roth joins us from U.S. News and World Report here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Out in Los Angeles, where, you know, anti-gun politicians have been busy passing more anti-gun ordinances in a state with the most anti-gun laws on the books, violent crime is up this year. Yep. Homicides up 27.5% compared to last year. Violent crime overall up 12.7%. Property crime's down 2%. And so the LAPD Assistant Chief Earl Pasinger told police commissioners at their weekly meeting on Tuesday that, you know, really all things considered, overall crime is up less than 1 point from this time last year. So, hey, we're good, right? Sure, if you consider, you know, well, we've got fewer burglaries, but we have more homicides to be good. Then, yeah, everything's great in Los Angeles. But if, on the other hand, you think that maybe homicides are a, you know, bigger indicator and violent crime maybe a bigger indicator of problems than property crimes, maybe things aren't going so great here. Assistant Chief Jorge Villegas cautioned that the percentages would probably fluctuate, according to the L.A. Times, as the year progressed. He said the rise in homicides more pronounced in part because of lower than normal numbers seen in February and March of last year. I said the LAPD has deployed several strategies to combat the uptick in violent crime, increasing gang intervention and prevention efforts, doubling down on community outreach. The department also expanded its Metropolitan Division, a group of highly trained officers who flood crime hotspots to prevent further violence. Villegas says it's not like these strategies don't work. They clearly work. The evidence to that is this. With the strategies that we have in place, our violent crime arrests are up. And with these strategies that we have in place, our property crime is down. We've seen a 9.5% increase in arrests of violent crime suspects this year. Interesting that the LAPD not promoting, not touting the new anti-gun ordinances that the city council has passed as major public safety additions, right? I mean, you've got the ordinance that says if you are a legal gun owner in the state of California or in the city of Los Angeles, that you have to have your handgun locked up at all times, unless it is on your person for self-defense. Magazines over 10 rounds have been banned in Los Angeles, and you're not allowed to possess them legally anymore. You had to turn them in. Nobody did. Or you had to get them out of Los Angeles, but you can't legally own them in the city anymore. And the police aren't talking those efforts up. That's, huh. L.A. Times says the divisions there, the LAPD, brought in more officers to conduct parole and probation checks and signal to potential offenders that police were paying attention. Officers also reached out to gang intervention workers and are working with neighboring law enforcement agencies to better understand gang violence that crosses city lines. Deputy Chief Robert Arcos said, what we're trying to do is to get people to cool off, to take a breather. That's really our goal, to get them to stop. Meanwhile, Deputy Chief Bill Scott, who oversees the LAPD's South Bureau, says the increase in homicides in his bureau most obvious in the Southwest Division. He said last year the division didn't see a homicide until March. This year, seven people have been killed. Four of those homicides, he said, appear to be gang-related. So again, if you what's the LAPD doing right now compared to Chicago, for instance, where homicides are up over 100% from this time last year? They say, well, we're getting into the community. We're working with other law enforcement agencies. We are doubling down on our gang efforts. Meanwhile, in Chicago, they disbanded the gang units. Right? Took the complete opposite step. Didn't want those cowboy units, I believe was the phrase that Gary McCarthy, the former superintendent there in Chicago, used. Well, hopefully the numbers in Chicago and Los Angeles go down, but it is interesting to note that the gun laws on the books there in Los Angeles do not appear to be reducing violent crime. One neighborhood, 18 shootings over a two-week period. Deputy Chief Arco said, I'm grateful for the property crime trend. We'll definitely take that, but the city's violent crime is up 12%. We're one of the anchors, he said. We need to focus on trying to keep that violent crime reduced. Well, if your city leaders are out there still paying more attention to the law-abiding gun owners, what few remain there in Los Angeles, your elected officials and your law enforcement may be working across purposes there. All right, coming up, top of hour three, we have our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense. Yes, another armed citizen story for you. I know that we've already done one. Also, Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right will join us coming up in hour two. CNN, good for CNN. CNN actually with a tweet. Escaped murder suspect Raphael Arnez McLeod shot dead during a home burglary in Mississippi, sheriff says. So maybe that story we talked about out of Vicksburg is going to be one of the few armed citizen stories that garners some national attention. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us in hour three as well, talking about some of the big news and issues of the day. We have more legislative news from around the country to get to. And I also want to talk more about that piece at The Atlantic by a professor at Georgia Tech, The Armed Campus in the Anxiety Age. Stick around. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this.
Speaking with Chris Brackett of Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak, and that is on Outdoor Channel and also Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing amazing.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, so let's get started. First, tell folks, what is Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil? What's that all about?
So Fear No Evil is a deeper, darker look at why any crazy person would sit in a tree from dusk till dark and do all the things that we do as hunters. And, you know, sometimes you find yourself just, why am I doing this? I'm sitting here and I'm freezing to death. But it's a, you know, deep, dark look at big game hunting, and it takes you on a roller coaster of emotions. Most people say, you know, our show's different than others. Ours really, we try to capture a 30-minute movie. So each one is different than the other one. And you know, some of them may be funny. Some of them may make you cry. Other ones, you know, takes you on a roller coaster. And it, you know, the industry is a change in that way. And we wanted to really make a one where your wife will sit down and watch, you know, and she doesn't watch normal hunting shows.
And I think that's great, Chris, because it's good to get inside the mind of a hunter, because most people who don't hunt look at them going, why in the world would you want to do that?
Yeah, you have different classifications of different outdoor television, right? You have entertainment, you have education, and then you have this kind of, you know, the kind of the old standard of, okay, here comes a deer, cutaways, this and that. And, and everybody likes one for a different. And for years, for the last 10 years, we just decided to make it completely organic in its own art.
So tell me, and I know we could probably talk about this all afternoon.
Right, I love it. Yeah.
What is it? Where do you get that passion? What can you tell people in 30 to 40 seconds here why you do what you do? Why is it so, to the non-hunter, so great?
For me, it's absolutely, it is in my blood. Number one, I can't not go after something. Number two is that, you know, God kind of put it on me to inspire and educate through entertainment, and that's my mule. That's my entertainment.
That was excellent. So that's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak. That's on Outdoor Channel. Now let's shift gears with Chris. Let's talk about Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. What is that all about?
So Arrow Affliction is the almost opposite of Fear No Evil. Fear No Evil is this dark. It's almost like, you know, you love chocolate ice cream, you love vanilla ice cream. Well, it's kind of the lighter side of bow hunting. Fun with arrows, shoot everything, hunt the way you and me got a BB gun and did everything that we could think of as 10, 12 year olds, and now we're grown men doing the same thing with arrows. Hunting bullfrogs, ducks, doves, geese, pheasants out of the air, just shooting and really pushing yourself.
So is it tough for you, Chris? I mean, that's a lot of plates to spin, a lot of balls to juggle, to have those two TV shows in production. Does it get tough?
Yeah, and we went a different route. I was born and raised in the Midwest, and I'd had nothing, and I created it from nothing. So it truly is an American dream being able to do this. But at the same time, what everybody really has to understand is that I don't have any kids. I don't even have a mortgage on a house. I rent a house. I give everything to my art to inspire and educate all the viewers. And so for us to do it, we're on the road, you know, most of the year. I started in September 1. I just ended 5 days ago killing a giant Boone and Crockett deer in Ohio. And I've devoted my entire life for everybody else to enjoy the adventures that we go on.
Your passion is total. It's all out.
it's full throttle, man.
It's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak on Outdoor Channel and Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, how can people get more information about Chris Brackett and about your great shows?
Well, the best way is you can go to fearnoevil.com, the website.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is on the air right now. Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Ride coming up. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media. We've got the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, coming up in just a couple of minutes as well. We've been talking a little bit about this piece at the Atlantic, The Armed Campus in the Anxiety Age. A professor at Georgia Tech, Ian Bogost, on why he does not think that campus carry is a good thing. He said, today's college students are beset by unease. And he said, it's no wonder why their whole lives have been lived bathed in vague and constant threat. Today's 21-year-old students were born in 1995. They were kindergartners on 9/11. Their whole childhoods were backgrounded by forever war. Their primary and secondary schooling took place under the supposed reforms of No Child Left Behind, which meant an education designed around lots of high-stakes testing and the preparation necessary to conduct it. They entered high school just after the 2008 global financial crisis, after which declines in the tax base led to billions of dollars of funding cuts to primary, secondary, and post-secondary public education. The professor says, meanwhile, tuition rose precipitously as funding declined and as state funding has waned. Flagships like UGA and Georgia Tech have increasingly pursued more lucrative out-of-state enrollments, while increasingly relying on gifts, endowments, grants, and contracts. Estate funding has become a minority contributor to institutional budgets. It's also become harder to get into college. A couple of answers difference on the SAT test might mean the difference between getting into Georgia Tech and going to some quote-unquote lesser school there. Every aspect, he says, of these kids' lives are drawn taut. One badly timed sneeze can spell disaster. You know, look, on one hand, everything the professor says, yeah, these kids who are 20, I'm sorry, these adults who are 21, born in 1995, they were kindergartners when 9/11 happened. They grew up in a quote-unquote forever war. Look, I grew up, Cameron, you grew up, do you remember The Day After? Do you remember that TV miniseries?
Oh, yes.
Remember watching that on TV as a kid?
And it's funny you
remember
that
scaring the bejeebers out of you?
Every I know I've talked about this before. They have Carson on now, and it's Antenna TV, and I watch Carson every night. And it's funny because there's so many the day after references. It's very strange that you bring that up because it was one of those, like, you know, we didn't have all the media we have now. So at the time, it was one of those, like, huge moments in television, which was a huge moment in media. So it was really the thing to talk about. And Carson was, you know, would talk about it all the time. So, yes, that was definitely, it was kind of like, you know, up there with, like, Roots and The Last MASH when we had very few TV options. It was the some of the quintessential TV shows from both of our childhoods, and the ones that were the milestones.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, kids in the 1950s grew up with Duck and Cover. Kids in the 1960s grew up with the ever-present threat of Vietnam being drafted, the Cold War. We grew up under the threat of the Cold War, and if you were born after 1945, you grew up in a world in which nuclear annihilation was a possibility, no matter how remote or how close it felt at times. So, again, no offense to college students today, but you're not the first generation to grow up in uneasy times. We have lived in uneasy times for a few generations here. So I'm not swayed by the argument of, you know, look, these are just kids who have grown up under unease. Okay, we've had that. We've had that before. The professor says, guns arrive on campus today in this context of massive wholesale collegiate anxiety. Furman de Brabender, who we talked about a little bit on the program yesterday, professor of philosophy in Maryland, had another piece, I think, at the Atlantic on his opposition to campus carry. Furman de Brabender, the good professor there at Georgia Tech, says, is right to worry that they might have a chilling effect on speech, but the chill goes so much deeper, straight to the bone. A concealed carry campus becomes a campus in which everyone carries a potential gun. Wait. Everyone carries a potential gun. Not potentially everyone carries a gun. Here's the thing. Why does a campus carry measure make it a campus in which everyone carries a potential gun? At Georgia Tech, when you've had students robbed at gunpoint in dorms in a gun-free zone. At Georgia State, where the library had to be shut down because of the number of armed robberies that students were being subjected to this school year in a gun-free zone. What is it about campus carry that all of a sudden makes this campus someplace where everyone carries a potential gun? Because it seems to me like right now the criminals don't give a damn about the gun-free zones that exist in Georgia or elsewhere. And the potential gun, the professor says, is far more powerful than the real gun, because it both issues and revokes a threat all at once. Made habitual and spread atop an already apprehensive base, that sort of mental anguish is nothing short of terrorism. Yes, you have this now? Campus carry is terrorism, according to this professor. Now, keep in mind, again, these college students who are stressed and anxious and they're flipping out about everything, according to what this professor is saying, presumably they are stepping foot off campus at some point, right? Entering the larger world of the state of Georgia, maybe even traveling outside of the boundaries of the state of Georgia, and they're interacting with people in an environment where concealed carry is lawful and legal and allowed. So why is it that these students appear to be far more stressed and anxious about being on a college campus than being off a college campus these days? I don't think it's campus carry that's stressing these students out. It might be some of their fellow students and professors that's stressing them out. The professor there at Georgia Tech says, think back to those online comments from my students, even if they were merely playful, which is really all that they were. They suddenly seem threatening once firearms are in the picture. I don't know. You know, to me, again, like, there's no playful way of saying I'm going to kidnap your children and blackmail you. Dark humor, I suppose. But, yeah, you know, again, campus carry, no campus carry. As a professor, I'd be bothered by that. The professor there at Georgia Tech says, you don't even need a gun to make it happen. The idea of a gun is sufficient. And that's just me, he says. I'm the one with the tenured professorship. Now imagine the students all trying to make it through my class and everything else with all those ideas of guns in the room and on the quad. Again, how do these same students and professors function off campus then? In a society in which there are plenty of concealed carry holders around. Maybe more importantly, do these same students and professors who would flip out, apparently, at the prospect of a licensed concealed carry holder carrying on campus there in Georgia, how do they handle the knowledge that right now somebody can come onto their campus in violation of that gun-free zone and commit a violent crime? Do they think about that at all? Because that's a reality, too. You know, again, we've seen this happen in Georgia this calendar year. We've seen these stories of students robbed on campus now. So how do these students and these professors who are so anxious about the prospect of campus carry, how do they deal with that reality? Do they think about it? Do they confront that reality? Do they run from that reality? They pretend that, well, maybe we just need to make the signs a little bit bigger so maybe the criminals will see this is a gun-free zone, and then they'll pay attention. How do you respond to that reality? The professor there at Georgia Tech says, an unspoken secret about firearms is that both proponents and opponents of gun laws share a common position that guns ascribe a feeling of power and control to their bearers. Gun detractors are foolish, he writes, not to acknowledge this truth of firearms, and they are reckless for sneering at gun owners who seek legal refuge in this feature of the weapons. Yes, he says, we pay a dear price measured in mortal lives for that feeling of control and power when firearms are used improperly. And yes, he says, as a nation, we seem to have decided that this price is acceptable, but not just from insanity or evil. When violence does erupt, he says, it finds its source in fear and anger and hopelessness more than it does in mental instability. Absent other comforts and certainties, is it any wonder that firearms become such tempting salve? And keep in mind, by the way, gun ownership has been on the increase in the United States. Violent crime has been on the decrease in the United States, but seems like this guy maybe has some issues beyond just campus carry when it comes to firearms. Yeah? He says that guns on campus are having their moment right now is no accident. The entire college experience, along with the supposedly prosperous young adulthood into which college spills out, is imploding under the weight of unprecedented apprehension. And worst of all, he says that apprehension isn't even neurotic and overzealous. It's entirely reasonable for young people to fear a future that has never been more tenuous. He says there are reasons to fear on college campuses, but those fears are misdirected at hypothetical bad guys with guns against whomever good guys with guns would prevail. Again, there's nothing hypothetical about this. You really did have robberies of students at Georgia Tech in their dorm rooms. You really did have the campus library at Georgia State closed for public safety because of all of the armed robberies that were occurring there on campus this year. Those aren't hypotheticals. Those aren't hypothetical bad guys. These aren't hypothetical good guys. These are real students who were really subjected to violent crimes in a place that was not really a gun-free zone, even though the signs may have said it was. The professor says, we had better spend our worry and our legislative effort de-escalating the massive anxiety among college students today. We can do that by providing the resources to teach them well as kids, to give them affordable opportunities to pursue higher education, and to help them secure productive places in society matched to their talents and capacities. The great tragedy and sorrow, he says, of the push to extend gun rights to every nook and cranny of American life is not that firearms make people feel greater power and greater control in those contexts, is that they are so stripped of that power and control that they should need to seek solace in guns in the first place. You poor, befuddled fools who want to get your concealed carry license, who think that carrying a firearm for your personal protection will keep you safe. Can't you see what the wise college professor sees? That, oh, this is just a screen for your deeper, darker anxieties about the future, and you're just clinging bitterly to your firearms because you have no real job prospects in this tenuous future. Or it could be that, you just don't want to be the victim of a violent crime. right, could be that you want to be able to protect yourself and defend yourself. Could be that you already have your concealed carry license, you're already carrying around the state of Georgia, and now that you're taking a class, or who knows, teaching a class, you want to be able to walk safely to your car, both on campus and off campus, and know that you can protect yourself if you are the victim of an armed robbery or a mugging. It could be that, too. But this professor, who is so intent on denigrating those who would carry a firearm for self-defense, those who would have a firearm for self-defense, cannot actually acknowledge the individuals who would be carrying for self-defense if campus carry becomes law. He's not willing to acknowledge that that their concerns are genuine. He's certainly not willing to acknowledge that their rights are real. That is all just a response to the fear and anxiety that they are facing. And we, you know, maybe free college. That's the way to make everybody feel better. Yeah. All right, let's get to the deal of the day. Hero of the day, good guy of the day. Our hero of the day from WKRN in Nashville, Tennessee. Hero of the day sponsored by AdCorps Defense. Channel 2 in Nashville says a tenant is not expected to face charges after he shot and killed a man who reportedly broke into a South Nashville apartment late on Thursday. Happened at the Hickory Point Apartments on Old Hickory Boulevard near Nolensville Road around 11:15 in the evening. According to a release by police, the 27-year-old resident called authorities after he woke up to a loud banging noise outside of his bedroom window. Man stated that he retrieved his pistol. He remained in his bedroom after he saw a man identified as Francisco Rodriguez kicking in his back door. The victim said when the 21-year-old man opened his bedroom door, he ordered him to freeze. The tenant told police he fired shots after Rodriguez reached for his waistband. Rodriguez was struck once, attempted to flee on foot before he collapsed. Police said he was found to be carrying a pistol in his right front pocket and was wearing a sock on his right hand. The resident, according to WKRN, cooperated with police, not facing any charges. The apartment complex is a gated community, Channel 2 notes, and officers are investigating to determine how the suspect got inside. You know, again, even a gated community, even a home with an alarm system, these things are not impermeable barriers for someone who is intent on getting inside your home. Thankfully, again, this resident there at the Hickory Points apartment in Nashville, Tennessee, was able to protect himself. We'll keep our eyes on that story, give any more details as they become available. The deal of the day today from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Channel 6 in Philly. Now, WPVI, there's a problem here. Their headline, man arrested in triple shooting, no stranger to criminal justice system. The story talks about a triple stabbing in Philadelphia. Dan Quaylar and Chad Pedrelli have not apparently updated this story to make the headline match with the actual story. But 55-year-old Ronald Stanley in West Philadelphia is facing several charges, including one count of murder, two counts of criminal homicide, aggravated assault, simple assault, related offenses in connection with a triple stabbing that left one person dead and two others injured in West Philadelphia. And Channel 6 says police say that Stanley had a revolving door at the criminal justice system with a slew of 31 prior arrests dating back to 1985. Prior charges include robbery, theft, drugs, assault, other offenses. WPVI says somehow he managed to game the system and he was out on the streets on Tuesday. Somehow. What do you mean somehow? I got news for WPVI. This guy didn't game the system. This is the system. This guy gamed the system, quote unquote, because none of his crimes ever ended up on the front page of the news before. Because he never led the nightly news on Channel 6 before now. And so the system didn't have any reason to treat him any differently than they treat anybody else in the system who hasn't been on the front page of the paper, who hasn't been on the lead story in the nightly news. He did not game the system. This is how the system works. Joanne Walker is with the Anti-Violence Partnership. It's a victims advocacy group. She says the victim is often twice victimized here, the first time by the crime itself, often traumatized the second time by the criminal justice system. Yeah. She said the events like last night, as I watched that unfold on the news and I watched it, I kept adding them up. She said it affected me, and I thought about the families that we would be seeing. Clifford Medley was sitting in his car outside of a Cricket wireless store when he says this guy jumped into his passenger seat and began stabbing him. Didn't know the alleged attacker, Ronald Stanley. Clifford Medley said his eyes were so red, he had a straight look face like he just wanted to kill. He didn't say nothing. He just came in swinging a knife at me. Medley was able to fight him off, suffered some wounds to both hands. A couple of minutes earlier, police say that Stanley had stabbed 31-year-old Roosevelt Gray, who was in that wireless store. After Medley dropped him off, Medley says he came out, he was hollering that he was stabbed in the chest. Police say Stanley then walked across the street to 30-year-old Nathan Atkinson, who was talking to his girlfriend while getting his car fixed. Stanley then stabbed Atkinson in the chest. The victim staggered in the middle of Baltimore Avenue, where he collapsed. Philadelphia police captain James Clark said he'd only been here for about 5 minutes. He was having some problems with his car. Pulled up into the lot to try to have somebody look at him. Within minutes of getting out of his car, he was stabbed and killed. None of these victims known to the suspect here. The police lieutenant, John Walker, said it just appears as though he walked into the business, saw a person, just figured he'll stab him. Walks out, saw another person sitting in his car, took an opportunity, then walks across the street, sees this guy talking to his fiance, just walks right up on him, stabs him, and keeps on walking. 31 prior arrests. And no, Robert Stanley did not game the system. Robert Stanley was just a part of the system. And he is today's deal of the day. Maybe we need another gun control law there in Philadelphia. I bet that would take care of it. It'd also be nice if Channel 6 actually corrected the headline to reflect the fact that this was a stabbing, not a shooting. But I know that's going to happen either. Our good guy of the day from Omaha, Nebraska. Actually, the Omaha World Herald. It's from Council Bluffs, Iowa, just across the state line there. Brian Souza lives in Council Bluffs, and it was Tuesday morning this week. He got his 3-year-old daughter, Jordan, strapped into her car seat, driving her to preschool there before he headed off to work, and they got to the preschool, and then they noticed something was missing. Brian said she noticed it first. She said, "Daddy, my backpack, my blankie's in there." And I thought, oh my God, I left it on top of the car. Now, as a parent, chances are this will happen to you at some point. And it sucks. Particularly when your child is not old enough to understand. Sometimes mistakes happen. Things get lost. No, they really can't be replaced. It's hard to explain that concept of, I know you did nothing wrong, but your favorite thing in the world has just disappeared forever. You don't get your blankie back. It's hard for a 3-year-old to accept that and understand that. So, Brian spent the rest of his day going back between his house and the preschool looking for the backpack with the blankie inside. He said, "I was checking outside, I was checking under cars, I was checking people's trash cans." He said, there was nothing. Meanwhile, Council Bluffs Police Officer Dale Schmitz had been driving to work that morning, and he noticed a car in front of him with a pink backpack on the roof. But they were going in two different directions. And so by the time Officer Schmitz was able to turn around, the car was gone, but the backpack was there in the street. So Dale Schmitz, 18-year veteran of the Council Bluffs Police Department, a father of a young child of his own, picked up the backpack, and he started looking through it, trying to get any sort of identifying information there. He said the only thing we could find was the name Jordan on a piece of paper inside the backpack. So he did what he could. He took the backpack to a couple of elementary schools in the area. Do you know, do you have a student named Jordan who might have this backpack? Couldn't find anything. Says he took the backpack back to the office, set it aside, and then he got alerted to the fact, well, while he set it aside, Dad, meanwhile, was talking to friends. He posted on Facebook, I'm looking for the backpack. Can you help me find the backpack? Wednesday morning, Dale Schmitz posted a picture of the backpack and what information they had on the department's Facebook page. And then Brian Souza's friend saw the post there. The police department let him know what had taken place. And it was yesterday afternoon that young Jordan was reunited with her backpack and her blankie. Most importantly, her blankie. She also got to meet Officer Dale Schmitz. Dad says she just snuggled against her mom with a blankie. She didn't want to let go of it. Blankies are a serious business. Indeed, they are. And I think Officer Dale Schmitz got that. So for being in the right place at the right time and for taking the time to do the right thing, for reuniting a little girl with her blankie, we thank you, Officer Dale Schmitz, there in Council Bluffs, Iowa, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Now, when we come back after a quick timeout, Stacey Washington from Stacey on the Right joins us. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media coming up as well. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh,
so
glad here.
Tell us, what is Armed and Heels all about?
So Armed and Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed and Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No, no way.
No. So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. You seem to have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed and Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year. Beginning the first Wednesday in March, we're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing, so somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's a 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And, Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group. Pass it on, Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do. And thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media is going to join us here in a few minutes. Right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend from St. Louis, Stacy Washington, host of Stacy on the Right. How you doing, Stacy?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
You know, I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. I saw this story today. You know, I'm constantly looking for new sources of information and checking up on what the anti-gun media has to say. And so over at Raw Story, they've got a piece, Are Looser Gun Laws Changing the Social Fabric of Missouri? So I've got to ask you, first of all, Stacey, what do you think? Are Missouri's gun laws changing the fabric, the social fabric of your state?
Yeah, I'd say they are. We have record low crime in St. Louis County and Kansas City County or the counties of Kansas City. And we have freedom. You can feel it in the air when you see people not just concealed carrying, but open carrying, and not just handguns, but semi-automatic rifles, and nothing happens. Nobody dies. Nobody accidentally shoots themselves. It just flows on down the river like any other thing that happens in a law-abiding place. I read the piece, and I have to say, for someone who's from Missouri, he sounded so much like a pansy. And that's not something we crank out here a lot of anyway. We have a few, but we don't usually crank out pansies of such an epic degree as this guy. He fear-mongers. He talks about how on college campuses, the dynamic of simply having students who have a gun is going to change things so much in the classroom because professors who normally challenge students' status quo thinking will, you know, they have to be then afraid that students will shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
I would be more concerned that people on college campuses would be scared right now because the law hasn't gone into effect, because any crazy dimwit can come on the campus and treat it like a shooting gallery.
Well,
that's the concern.
You know, yes, you're right. And we were just talking about a piece in The Atlantic in the last segment, a professor at Georgia Tech writing about campus carry in the age of anxiety. And this was one of the things that this guy brought up, is that, you know, students are going to be so much more anxious and uncomfortable knowing that the person next to them, you know, could have a concealed firearm on them. Well,
or the again, person next to them could have nothing.
Or the right. And again, right now, the person next to them could also have a concealed firearm on them, but they're not going to be a concealed carry holder, likely. I mean, they're, you know, to ignore the to focus on the hypothetical and ignore what is actually taking place right now, that these gun-free zones are not stopping criminals from going on campus or targeting students right off campus for robberies and worse. We're seeing this in Georgia right now, and we're seeing this around the country. You know, a gun-free zone does not make for a crime-free place.
Well, it's worse than that, because what we've seen is there's video online of this. These two black guys, I'm sure you talked about this on your air, that they were in their barbershop, and some robber comes in, two of them with a rifle and a handgun, and they go to, you know, rob these people, and two guys who are concealed carry save the day. They mm-hmm. shoot one of the robbers and the other one gets away. And what about the story? There, I mean, there's so many. If you just pay attention a little bit, you don't even have to be plugged in to the same degree that I am or someone else who pays attention to this stuff. It's story after story after story of good guy with a gun, good chick with a gun. Some lady, a guy follows her into a elevator. He starts looking really aggressively towards her. She doesn't pull her gun until she's in her car and he's beating the stuffing out of her. Their confrontation was so violent, they busted out her front windshield, and then she draws her gun and puts a bullet in his neck. He survived, and now he's been indicted for kidnapping and all these other things, brought up on charges, and she survived. She's seriously injured, but she's going to live. All I hear are people whining about what might happen if Americans exercise their rights under the Constitution, whining about how dangerous it might be if the person next to me, who I normally see as just another good person, suddenly if they have a gun concealed on their person, they're a horrible person and they need to be feared and maybe not allowed onto the campus. This is the kind of it's mental. What's the word I'm looking for that we can use on the radio? It's mental poppycock. It's the kind of stuff that you normally find inside of a stuffed animal. It's fluff. It's fluffing. It's nothing that has any real cognitive ability. Yet it's present in the brains of millions of young Americans today, a latent fear of other Americans exercising their rights. And so I know this isn't a problem for your listeners, but I encourage people to start reaching out within their networks and teaching those around them that there is nothing to fear except putting up signs that say gun-free zone so crazy people know where to have their next, you know, gun gallery, their next shooting gallery.
Well, and I think, you know, I think part of what we have to do is combat the fluff with facts. For instance, this a gentleman at Raw Story, he said a team of researchers led by Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, analyzed extensive crime data from Missouri and found that the state's 2007 repeal of its permit to purchase handgun law, quote, was associated with a 25% increase in firearm homicide rates. Between 2008 and 2014, the Missouri gun homicide rate rose to 47% higher than the national average. Now, here's the thing. Missouri's homicide rate started going up before 2007, Stacey. You know, it started going up in, 2004? In 2003, your homicide rate in Missouri, 5.1 per 100,000 people. 2004, 6.1. 2005, 6.9. You know, again, it was on its way up before that law changed. Why didn't the anti-gun researcher talk about that?
Well, because it would have forced him to deal with the fact that it coincides with the creation of a juvenile court system. It's an extra court that's located in St. Louis County. I believe we talked about this almost a year ago right here on your show, how this court has a special set of judges, and they route all of the gang-related crimes from the inner city of St. Louis. So these are mostly black offenders, and they go out there, and they commit gun crimes. They go before this court, and they get a smack on the wrist. So after having committed a gun crime where they shot someone but didn't kill them, then they get to go back out and commit more crimes and re-recidivize because they were never punished in the first place. That court's creation coincides directly with the increase in gun violence and homicides in St. Louis. So I think what we have is, again, liberals like to cherry pick the different things that support their narrative. But those of us living here in St. Louis are darned happy we have so much freedom as it pertains to the Second Amendment and guns. And we tell other states, other people, friends who live elsewhere, you should follow our lead. Open up the ability for Americans to exercise their rights. And nobody's unhappy about it but the liberals. And they don't want to do anything to address the real issues, which crime, poverty, fatherlessness. If you look at the people who are doing the shootings, they're mostly black. If you look at the neighborhoods they're shooting up, they're mostly black. The victims, black. These are people who want to be protected, but they can't snitch on anybody because people get killed and set on fire in cars for talking to the police in those neighborhoods. We need to look at fatherlessness and bring down poverty and give these kids an educational choice. That's the way to lower homicide rates, gun violence, and all kinds of other horrible ills that are plaguing black families right now. And so it's so insulting to hear leftists cherry-picking facts and not addressing the true issues, all of which are caused by them, because guess who's been running St. Louis City and Kansas City for the last 55 years? Democrats.
Stacey Washington, host of Stacey on the Right. Appreciate you coming on the program. What are you going to be talking about this weekend on the show?
You know what? It's going to be probably a lot of discussion about the Parkway School District's new comprehensive sex education program that was created and written and brought to them by Planned Parenthood. And so I spent a lot of time last night at a meeting. I even gave public comment because we're taxpayers in that district, and they went ahead and passed the comprehensive sexual education program anyway. So that was after I was like totally pumped up because I'd been on Fox Business for the first time. And then I go to this meeting and I totally get all the air deflated out of my balloons because they passed this curriculum. Now my kids aren't impacted by it, but my tax dollars are paying for it. So they got a fight on their hands. It's me, about 50 other women, and we're growing our network as we speak. I had 110 text messages this morning. We're going to do something about this, and we're not going to let them spread it around to the other districts, Rockwood, Ladue. The other districts are already primed and ready and waiting for them to come and bring it in, and we're going to say no to that too.
There you go. Activism at its finest. Stacey, thank you for coming on the program. You can check out to Stacey, 97.1 FM. In St. Louis, Missouri, Saturday, 5 to 7 p.m. And, Stacey, I know we'll be talking again very soon.
I know. I'm so glad that I got to come on today.
I always love having you on the program. Thank you
too.
For, you know, when you're busy with Fox Business and all these other folks, just still remember Cam & Company, all right?
You know what? This is my home right here. I will always be here. I was just so surprised they let me go on Fox. I'm like, I'm a rabble-razzler. You guys sure you want me?
I think it's fantastic. Well, listen, we always love having you on the show. Go get them, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Cam.
All right, Stacey Washington joining us here on NRA News, Cam & Company. Stephen Kruser from PJ Media will be with us as well, coming up after a quick timeout, talking about some of the big stories of the day and of the week. So stick around. We will be back with much more NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking to our good friend John Anoni with 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. John, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
I am on top of the world.
How's Allentown?
Allentown is in need of some improvement, and I guess that's why I'm there.
Amen, brother. So first, before you get in, you got some neat projects I want to talk to you about. Yeah. But tell folks, what is 2 Million Bullets and what's Camp Compass? What do you do?
2 Million Bullets is actually an orange-ribbon campaign to prioritize our children in the youth shooting sports. That as well as Camp Compass, which is a nonprofit that rewards inner-city kids with outdoor excursions, basically hunting and shooting.
How long have you been doing this?
Ooh, I've been grinding a long time, 20 years. 20 years, 22 at the camp. I've been in the classroom for another 27. So we tend to say that there is nobody walking this earth that knows kids better than I.
Yeah, I would say that's true. So let's step back for a second before we talk about your new project. How did you get into all this?
You know, it wasn't by my choice, actually. You know, sometimes this road that I'm on is a pretty lonely road because saving kids is not an easy thing, especially, you know, you might as well put devil horns on me because not only do I save them through using the gun, but I save them through killing stuff.
Wow.
Basically our critters, you know, so it's
God's
something
little
where,
creatures, yeah, John. What kind of person are you?
You know what? According to my kids, a pretty darn good one, you know. it's something where, you know, I found this because of a need. And wanted to make sure that other kids who had the same need, you know, have that fulfilled.
Awesome. So what did that lead to first? What's the timeline?
You know, Camp Compass, you know, I actually started out of the back of my truck in 94. Just thought the books weren't cutting it and needed to reflect on my life to see what made a difference in my life. And, of course, it was shooting. And it was hunting non-traditionally, of course. With that, went back into the classroom to teach to try to help and just figured out that it was something that I needed to give back.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. What you're doing now and been doing for 20 years couldn't be more important now because there's a lot of talk about not only about hunter numbers, and some people say they're going up, they're going down, But it's not just that. It's just attack on that lifestyle, on hunting, on the outdoor sports, on shooting, like from people on the other side who have really ramped up the rhetoric. It just, I mean, your devil horns, John, are growing bigger and bigger and bigger because they think you're so evil.
You're right. And you know what? You know what? If I could kind of counter that a little bit, you know what's starting to be a pretty neat role that's starting to happen is people on the other side are starting to come to me and say, you know what? I'm looking at this a little differently because you're saving our kids. And you know, it's something where it's hard to be the king of both mountains, but I can tell you that there are some people on the other mountain that are starting to climb up mine because they understand that our kids, their lives are critical. And they want to see ultimately kids win just like we do. And I think we're starting to convince some people that what we do is a pretty good thing.
Awesome. All right, so let's talk about the new camp. What do you have going on? Something new.
You know what? Actually, we have a new documentary that is coming out called Camouflaging Our Differences. Pretty strong title. And I say that with excitement because I think we get a knock in the industry in regards to who the industry is, you know, who the industry is portrayed to be. And I can tell you, I walk the halls and I meet with people constantly that are of color and of non-color. And I can tell you what, the bottom line for us is kids. So that's the reason we decided to name it Camouflaging Our Differences. It may shake some people up a little bit because they might be a little uncomfortable. However, change is coming.
Sometimes, John, people need to be shaken up a little bit.
Well, and I don't do it, you know, because I get a rise out of it. I do it.
No,
because
I mean
it's,
with respect.
No. Understood. Yeah. I do it because you know it's necessary for me to save kids' lives. And you know, I could walk 30 kids through this hall today, and they would receive the same love that I would get, probably even more, because once again, our people want to see these kids win. Not necessarily in a pro-gun agenda, but in life.
Right. All right, John Anoni, 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. How do we get more information about all the great things that you're doing?
You know what? You can look me up on those sites, 2 Million Bullets, 2millionbullets.com.org, or campcompass.com or .org, and you'll find me there.
John Anoni, thank you so much for what you have done and what you continue to do, and thanks for visiting us here at NRA News.
Ah, pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. And 1985, I believe, right? Winger. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media joins us on the program. How you doing, Steven?
Did I get the winger lead in? That's nice. I'm fine, thank you.
I was going to call you the winger of PJ Media, but it's
my
not...
My teeth aren't good enough.
It's not, right? I still remember that about the video. Like he looked like a hobo, and then all of a sudden he smiled. You're like, "Wow, that hobo has a great smile."
And then it looked like a late night dentist commercial as soon as he smiled.
Exactly right. And I always wanted to perfect that play the bass while spinning around in the circle move that Kip Winger had down. But alas, it was not to be. Never had the good hair either. But that's all right. So, how's life in your world?
I'm in transit on the lovely 405 right now because I had to run a time specific errand that I couldn't finish in time for this interview. So, but we're good. And the traffic is moving, so I'll take that.
Wow, that's kind of unusual for the 405,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I now granted, I've not spent a lot of time in LA, but most of the time that I've spent in LA, I've spent in traffic in LA.
Yeah.
So is there a good time? Is there ever a good time to try to get around and run these types of errands?
Not really. On the 405, it's generally bad. They're slightly less awful going south in the late morning and north where I am right now in the early afternoon. This is the reason I moved to the west side. I moved to the west side and I don't go anywhere because I don't want to deal with freeways. And now everybody just, they say I'm antisocial, but I'm not really. I just like, if you come to the west side, I'll socialize with you. If I have to go somewhere, it's done.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt like when I lived up in the D.C. area, because at some point, I mean, it's just this huge sprawling megalopolis, right? And it just takes hours to get anywhere. And so you do. You just ultimately your world shrinks down. And even though you live in this massive city, your world kind of revolves around the few blocks that you can get to without it taking forever and ever to find a way there and then to park and whatnot.
It's 2016. Pour a drink and FaceTime with your friends. It'll be fine, okay? It's modern socialization. Don't make it difficult.
There you go. So did you tune into the Democratic debate last night at all?
Not last night. I was busy with some parenting stuff last night, but I was watching Twitter watch it. And I didn't know if I could handle the level of pandering that would have to happen because it was an Univision debate. But I did enjoy watching Twitter watch it.
Yeah, that was kind of how I took it in last night as well. I do plan on watching the Republican debate tonight if parenting doesn't impede that. But it was interesting because one of the things that Twitter kind of erupted about was when Hillary Clinton was asked, "So if you're indicted, are you gonna step down as a candidate?" And couldn't even get an answer like, "Well, yeah, if that ever happened, but I don't think it's gonna happen. Sure, I would." It was just that'll never happen. I'm not even gonna answer that question. Seems to me like, you know, look, as a candidate, certainly you want to reassure your potential voters that hey, I'm good. You can count on me to be there. At the same time, Stephen, there is an active FBI investigation going on, and Hillary Clinton has no idea, I don't think, has any idea how this is going to turn out.
Oh, I think she does, though. I think the Obama Justice Department has been telegraphing quite clearly how this is going to turn out. I think it's the whole reason that Loretta Lynch recused herself from Supreme Court consideration, because then suddenly you have to look at, you know, things that she may be working on at the time to see how she. So I think the DOJ has pretty much said, yeah, we're going to stonewall this till well after the election. And then, do you really want to indict the president? I think that's where this is going to go.
Oh, so you think we won't see anything? This will just be sort of hanging over Hillary's head throughout the campaign, but. But that sort of, and it may even be an unspoken argument, right? Well, if Hillary's going to get elected, if she gets elected, then nothing's going to happen, right? Because as you say, who's going to indict the president? So if you want this to go away, then the best way for this to go away is to vote for Hillary Clinton. Is that going to be the cynical argument that is laid out there?
Something like that, because you know what the Clinton supporters for 20-some-odd years now, their mantra has always been, well, they've never been indicted. You know, that's what people say about the people who love the Clintons. Well, they've never been indicted. And it's true. They find a way to not get indicted. And that's how they're able to, with straight faces, keep saying, oh, this is all made up. This isn't real. This is because somehow they're the Al Capone. We got to get them on some weird tax thing. They're the Al Capone of American politics.
Talking again with Stephen Kruiser of PJ Media, the Al Capone of American politics. And, you know, the trustworthiness and honesty. And not really, you know, she's not getting a lot of those voters who find those attributes to be particularly important in a presidential figure. You know, to that end, on Tuesday of this week, Bernie Sanders with a surprising upset in the Michigan primary. And I'm curious, Stephen, you know, this was supposed to be, you know, a slam dunk for Hillary Clinton. She was not supposed to have any opposition here. And yet, despite the fact the media is much more interested in talking about what's going on in the Republican primaries, there is a deep division between Hillary Clinton supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters over on the Democratic side of the aisle.
It's pretty ugly, too. And I think what happened in Michigan was Hillary was just arrogant. She thought, okay, I've got Wayne County and it's mostly black voters and I can just count on that. And I think she was probably dismissive of the rest of the state. It also might be indicative of the fact that Bernie Sanders is learning how to put a ground game in place, too, which I think before there was just a lot of emotional enthusiasm, but he may have just outplayed her in the rest of the state, too. But the division is very real. It's not going to get talked about in the press because the press can't talk about the Democrats in that way. They can pretend that this is just sort of a thing and it's going to go away sooner or later. But it's the rift, I think, over there is as big as the one on the right. And this, with them, it's there are progressives in the Democratic Party who are tired of being in the closet. They want to just come out and say, look, we're a progressive party.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's interesting because there are all kinds of questions asked to Bernie Sanders. Are you just in it to pull the party to the left? He says, no, I'm in it to be president. But without a doubt, I think that he is pulling Hillary Clinton to the left. I mean, Hillary Clinton has said things like, you know, look, we want to get to the same place, Bernie Sanders and I. I just think we need to take things slowly, take things one step at a time. He just wants to sort of rush headlong, you know, over the cliff here, and we'll end up in utopia on the other side. But if you want to end up at the same place as Bernie Sanders, Stephen, it seems to me like, you know, that's kind of an admission that ultimately we're really not that different.
Well, this is the real reason that there's so much consternation within the Democratic ranks right now. It's because they have been running a stealth progressive party for years, and that was their, that's what they wanted to keep doing. They wanted to, oh, you know, we're just regular Americans, and not really come out and admit that they were progressives. And Sanders is forcing them to start admitting that they are, in fact, progressive, and they don't like that. He's blown the lid off of their stealth campaign.
Talking again with Stephen Kruser of PJ Media. All right, Stephen, we only got a couple of minutes left. Anything that we should be looking for in the Republican debate tonight?
I'm curious to see, you know, the last couple of days have been so extraordinary with so many media people leaving the Rubio ranks and saying, hey, this Cruz-Rubio alliance probably should happen now. I'm curious to see if there are going to be any big surprise, like from one of them, you know, if they're both going to just stay away from each other, go after Trump, kind of like they did the last time. And we have to see how this evolves, because obviously things have changed since the other night. I mean, there are a lot of people who were just devout Rubio people who are saying it's not going well at the moment. And we need to start coalescing behind Cruz. And I want to see if that manifests itself at all in this. A lot of people have gone for some fantastical House of Cards scenarios where, you know, Rubio comes out at the end and says he's dropping out, but he supports Cruz. And then Cruz says, okay, he's going to be my VP. And that all sounds like television stuff. But then again, in this primary cycle, it could happen. I would have dismissed that out of hand in any other primary. I would say that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. In this one, I'm going to watch just to see if that happens, because it might.
Talking again with Stephen Kruser, PJ Media. Listen, we appreciate the time, Stephen. Enjoy traffic. And
I just got home. I tried.
Bravo. Good for you.
Okay.
Listen, it's you know, it's what happens when you come on Cam and Company. Just good things happen. Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and your audience.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Stephen Kruser from PJ Media joining us here on NRA News Cam and Company. We only have about 60 seconds or so left in today's program. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air will join us on the program. Also, Derek Hunter, host of the Derek Hunter Show out in Baltimore, Maryland, talking about the latest anti-gun efforts there in Annapolis. Our friend Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC, will join us as well. We will also talk about this horrific crime outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Police are looking for two suspects responsible for the death of six individuals, including a woman who was pregnant, 8 months pregnant. No motive being offered for this attack, but apparently a pair of individuals opening fire on this social gathering, this family cookout, basically, in a backyard. We're going to talk more about that story tomorrow's NRA News Cam and Company. Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, and more. It's all coming up. We'll see you here soon on the next edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.